Motor City Riffs.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riffs Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, a little change today, you guys. I'm Kelly Brown, sitting in for Peter Werby this week and next week. Peter is following character. He's in Caracas, Venezuela for the next 2 weeks, the next two Sundays, attending the World Social Forum. It's a gathering of non-governmental organizations trying to bring about social and economic justice. See Peter's site, peterwerby.com, for information on the event. And actually, he told me that he might be calling us this week or next week, which would be interesting to find out exactly what they're accomplishing in Caracas. Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF. This is the award-winning Night Call. I'm Kelly Brown. Thank you so much, Doug and Peter, for having faith in me enough to sit in for Peter. It's an honor. And thank you to Jay Hudson, who is producing the program. Well, let's get to some stories. Some current events that are happening this week. No word on the fate of Ann Arbor journalist Jill Carroll. Friday was the deadline set by her kidnappers. Now, in the paper today, I read in the news that it says a U.S. Muslim advocacy group arrived in Baghdad to plead for her release yesterday. So many Iraqi people are behind her because of her respectful journalism and stories she published in the Christian Science Monitor about the Iraqi people. Basically, really getting down to business and telling the truth about what's going on over there. Now, you know, she's from Ann Arbor. I said that already. A vigil was set this week in South Lyon, headed by my mom, actually, Judy Brown. My family in South Lyon are friends with her family and are definitely thinking about her. Our thoughts and prayers are with you for your safe return, Jill. Yeah, that's an intense one. But maybe no news is good news, you know? In other news, President Bush seems to be in a little hot water again. By a margin of 52% to 43%, Americans want Congress to impeach President Bush if he so did wiretap American citizens without a judge's approval. According to a new poll commissioned by After Downing Street.org, a grassroots coalition that supports a congressional investigation of President Bush's decision to invade Iraq in 2003. Now, the poll was conducted by Zogby International. It's a highly regarded nonpartisan polling company. The poll interviewed 1,216 U.S. citizens from January 9th through 12th of this year. The poll found that 52% agreed with the statement. If, quote, if President Bush wiretapped American citizens without the approval of a judge, do you agree or disagree that Congress should consider holding him accountable through impeachment? 43% disagreed, and 6% said they didn't know or declined to answer. Now, this poll has a 2.9% margin of error. Quote, the American people are not buying Bush's outrageous claim that he has the power to wiretap American citizens without a warrant. Americans believe terrorism can be fought without turning our own government into Big Brother. And that is from AfterDowningStreet.org, co-founder Bob Farrick. Now, it's interesting that the timing of the Osama tape. As soon as Bush is in a little hot water, out comes the Osama tape.
Please release Osama tape number 10.
Now, here's another interesting article, speaking of the Osama tape. A Duke professor says he is doubtful about Thursday's audio tape from Osama bin Laden. Bruce Lawrence just published Messages to the World, the Statement of Osama bin Laden, a book translating bin Laden's writing. He is skeptical about Thursday's message. He thinks it sounded like a voice from the grave, whatever that means. He thinks bin Laden is dead and has doubts about the tape. Lawrence recently analyzed more than 20 complete speeches and interviews of Osama bin Laden, of the leader, for his book. He says, now the new message is missing several key components. There's nothing in this tape from the Quran proving that he's a faithful Muslim. He quotes scripture in defense of his actions. There's no quotation from the Quran in his excerpts we got. No references to specific events. No references to past events like there has been in the past. You know, he's always, you know, talked about 9/11 or things that are going to happen in the future, and he doesn't see any of those key components. moving along to something a little more lighthearted and very positive for the environment. Willie Nelson drives a Mercedes. Yes, he does. But do not lose faith, true believers. The exhaust from Mr. Nelson's diesel-powered Mercedes smells like peanuts or French fries or whatever alternative fuel he happens to be putting in his tank these days. Now, the interesting thing is Willie Nelson has birthed his own brand of alternative fuel. Have you heard about this? It's called, fittingly enough, Bio Willie. And in Bio Willie, Mr. Nelson, 72, has blended two of his biggest concerns, his love of family farmers and disdain for the Iraqi war. Now, Bio Willie is a type of biodiesel, a fuel that can be made from any number of crops and run in a normal diesel engine. If it sounds like a joke, a number of businesses, as well as city and state and country and county governments, have been switching their transportation fleets to biodiesel blends over the last year. Now, the rationale is that it's a domestic fuel that can provide profit to farmers as well as it will help the environment. Though environmentalists are not universally enthusiastic. Oh, it says, though environmentalists are not universally enthusiastic about it. I know we need to have something that would keep us from being so dependent on foreign oil. And when I heard about biodiesel, a light comes on. And then I said, hey, here's the future for the farmers, the future for the environment, the future for our truckers. Mr. Nelson went on to say in an interview this month, it seems that's good for the whole world if we can start growing our own fuel instead of starting wars over it. End of quote. In some ways, it is a return to the origins of the diesel engine. Some of Rudolf Diesel's first engines ran on peanut oil more than a century ago. That's interesting. Last week, a cargo loading company that operates in the port of Seattle said that to fuel its equipment next year, it would purchase, get this, 800,000 gallons of biodiesel. Most of it, a blend known as B20, that is 80% conventional diesel. Now, as of late September, Minnesota requires almost all diesel fuel sold in the state to be 2% biodiesel. It really sounds like we're moving forward with this kind of thing. Sometimes I'm blown away by this because you just never think that something like this is actually going to happen. Well, anyway, Cincinnati started using a 30% biodiesel blend, B30. And in its city buses because of concerns about fuel shortages after Hurricane Katrina. Well, good for them. Biodiesel can cost as much as a dollar gallon more than regular diesel when pure. Though it is typically sold as B20, prices vary depending on volume and region. The new tax incentives are aimed at closing the cost gap. Now, Bio Willie was selling for $2.37 a gallon yesterday at Carl's Corner, which is Mr. Nelson's own truck stop in Texas that serves as headquarters of his year-old company. Now, Willie Nelson Biodiesel. Oh, that's actually what his company is called, Willie Nelson Biodiesel. That was just 4 cents more than the conventional diesel selling at another station nearby. It's mostly aimed at truckers, as you can see. Bio Willie is currently sold at 13 gas stations and truck stops in 4 states, with Texas having the most. And it fuels the buses and trucks for Mr. Nelson's tour. Sounds like it's working out. What a cool thing. Good for you, Willie Nelson. All right, those of you that like to partake in the bud occasionally. A federal appeals court has upheld a 55-year prison term imposed on a Utah man with no criminal record who was convicted in 2003 of selling several hundred dollars worth of marijuana on 3 occasions. The case of the man, Weldon Angelos, a record producer from Salt Lake City who was 22 at the time of his crime, has become a benchmark in the debate about sentencing rules and justice. The trial judge in this case complained in ensuing the sentence, which was required by federal officials that they thought that it was excessive. And 29 former judges and prosecutors agree in a brief filed on Mr. Angelo's behalf. Now, three-judge panel of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, in a decision issued there late Monday, rejected those arguments. The sentence properly reflected the will of Congress, the court said, and was not cruel or unusual punishment. Mr. Angelos was reported by a witness to have been armed with a pistol during two of the drug sales, and requiring stiffer sentences in cases while drugs and violence are linked. The court said it is legitimate social policy. Now, the guns are one thing, you know, but 55 years, I don't know. Something's got to be done about this whole thing. If you go to any rehab facility these days, it's alcohol and Vicodin. It's not marijuana. Now, like I said, I'm not saying that this guy should be let off the hook. Armed robbery is definitely, you know, not something that you need to mess with. But, geez, 55 years for never having done anything wrong in his life. All right, here's an interesting story. For the 57th straight year, a mystery man paid tribute to Edgar Allan Poe by placing roses and a bottle of cognac on the writer's grave to mark his birthday. This has been going on. This guy has been doing this for 57 years. Some of the 25 spectators drawn to a tiny locked graveyard in downtown Baltimore for the ceremony climbed over the walls of the site and were running all over the place trying to find out how the guy gets in. According to Jeff Jerome. Now, he is the most faithful viewer of the event. Jerome is a curator of the Poe House and Museum. He said early Thursday that he had to chase people out of the graveyard, fearing that they would interfere with the mystery visitor's ceremony. They want him to come back. It's just such an event. In letting people know about the tribute, I've been contributing to these people's desire to catch this guy, Jerome said. It's such a touching tribute, and it's been disrupted by the actions of a few people trying to interfere and expose this guy. Jerome has been the mysterious visitor every January 19th since 1976. They had a game plan, Jerome said of the spectators. They knew from previous years what the guy would when the guy would appear. Now, Jerome declined to reveal details of what the Poe what the guy was wearing and what he did at the grave. They wanted to know if, along with the roses and the cognac, there was such thing as a note. It's such a mystery. It was a crisp, cold, clear night, and I was hoping for wind and rain in keeping with the Poe story, Jerome went on to say. But the museum curator was saddened by the disrespectful spectators. I hope to preserve this tribute. It's one of those things that make Baltimore so unique, he said. For decades, a frail figure made the visit to Poe's grave. In 1993, the original visitor left a cryptic note saying, "The torch will be passed." A later note said the man who appeared, who apparently died in 1998, had handed the tradition on to his sons. Poe, who wrote poems and horror stories such as The Raven and The Telltale Heart, died October 7th, 1849 in Baltimore at the age of 40 after collapsing in a tavern. Well, this is interesting. Vernon Reed, who actually I saw live in color a couple of weeks ago with the Magic Bag. They were amazing. They just get better and better and better and better. Vernon Reed is a guitar player for Living Color. Here's what happened to him recently. Inspiration comes in the strangest sources, especially for Vernon Reed, the guitarist for Living Color. Reed says that one of the most inspirational moments of his life came when he visited his grandfather's home in the Caribbean and saw a tree growing through the roof of an abandoned car. Now, he admits the locals probably thought it was just an eyesore, but for me, it was a profound statement of how machine and nature fuse together. Reed could relate, since as a guitarist, he often feels fused with technology in the same way. He figures the tree-car combo reminded him that no matter how gadgets advance, there's always a ghost in the machine, some element of humanity. Reed hopes to continue combining hardware with a heart in his upcoming release called Another True Self, a CD recorded with his other band, Vernon Reed and the Mask. The CD will be released April 18th. Followed by a U.S. tour. Highly recommended live. He is an awesome, awesome guitar player. Well, apparently there's more misery in people's lives today than a decade ago, at least among those who will tell you their troubles. So says a new study on life's negatives from the University of Chicago's National Opinion Research Center, which conducts social science research for government agencies, educational institutions, non-profit organizations, and private corporations. The researchers surveyed 1,340 people about negative life events and found that 2,004 respondents had more troubles than those who were surveyed in 1991. That was the last time the study was done. The anticipation would have been the problems would have been down. That's really what they thought was going to happen, says Tom Smith, the study's author. He says good economic years during the 90s would have brought an expectation of fewer problems, not more. Overall, the percentage who reported at least one significant negative event increased from 88% to 92%. It's not too bad, I guess. Most of the problems were related to increased incidence of illness and the inability to afford health insurance, medical care, mounting bills, unemployment, and troubled romantic relationships. We can all relate to that. That's an interesting study. And I'm sure it has a lot to do with the economy. You know, you've got people losing their jobs, you've got people losing health care, and that kind of thing increases the stress in your life. You know, it definitely does. All that and something else that is very close to my heart. Nickelodeon announces plans for a special SpongeBob SquarePants medieval primetime episode. No controversy there. I'm just personally very excited about that. 101 WRIF, I'm Kelly Brown. This is Night Call. Thanks for hanging out. Peter Werby is off for 2 weeks in Venezuela. Actually, he might call us, so that would be kind of cool. Next week on Night Call, something that is close to a lot of our hearts, healthcare, or lack thereof. Dr. Alan Olson from Marquette, Michigan, will be my guest via phone from the UP, so please join us for Night Call next week. Okay, on to something that is affecting probably almost 90% of you listening out there. Credit card bills. Credit card bills stressing you out? The proportion of consumers behind on their credit card bills remained near record high levels this year. You know, it has a lot to do with gasoline prices, rising interest rates, all kinds of stuff creates, you know, stress on personal budgets. Well, the American Bankers Association reported Tuesday that the percentage of credit card accounts 30 or more days past due dipped slightly to 4.74%. This past year, actually this past July-September quarter. It was at an all-time high of 4.8 in the spring. Now, even with the slight decline, consumer card delinquencies in the late summer and early fall were at their third highest level on record, prompting concerns about more problems to come. Signs of financial stress still are present, says James Chesnin, ABA's chief economist. Now, the persistent interest rate increases by the Federal Reserve and record-high gas prices in the third quarter provided a 1-2 punch that continued to inflict pain on personal budgets. Hear, hear. The Federal Reserve has increased interest rates 13 times. God, can you believe? 13 times they have increased interest rates since June 2004, with many economists believing that rates will go up another quarter point when the Fed meets on January 31st. That would push the Fed's target for the federal funds rate and the interest that banks charge to make the loans to other banks. It would push it to 4.5%. Now, I understand that you have to pay your credit card bills. You know, that's just part of life. You have to pay your bills. You sign on the dotted line and you read the fine print, you agree to fees and you agree to pay your bills on time. But what happens when you lose your job? What happens when you lose your health insurance and you have to feed your family? I'm sorry, but all responsibility to those credit cards go right out the window if you've got to feed your family and you've got to pay those bills. If your back is against the wall, you have to use your credit cards. Then they get maxed out. And how will you ever catch up with the fees they're now charging? It's almost impossible to keep up with these things. Now, recently, lobbyists got the Republicans to pass a bill making it much more difficult to file for bankruptcy, which, you know, I can see some people have been taking advantage of the whole bankruptcy thing. Some people have done that. So, you know, what are they going to do? But, I mean, I don't think that has a whole lot to do with those few people. So, you know, then what do? We're stressed out. Bill collectors are calling. Your credit report goes right down the tubes. Now, not to mention, you feel like a huge irresponsible loser. You know? Okay, so let's go to the phones. Is this affecting you and your family? If so, how? And is there a light at the end of the tunnel as far as some kind of a solution? It shouldn't have to take us 20 years to pay the credit card companies back $5,000. You know? And a lot of people are in this situation now. 313-298-WRIF. All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Rick, Nick from St. Clair Shores. What's going on, Nick from St. Clair Shores? What's on your mind? What's on your mind, Nick?
Hello?
Nick, what's on your mind?
Oh, hey.
Hey.
Hey, take a breath. You're doing just great.
Woo!
In Peter Werby's absence?
I never talked so much in my whole life.
Oh, my God, I know. I've known you for years and talked to you before. You're like, hey, la, la, la. But you're just doing just great.
Oh, thank you so much.
And, yeah, hey, come on, Detroit. Let's get up and run. Ah, yes!
Is that all that's on your mind?
Rhonda, I think what I want, I just call blindly every time I ever call night call. I call blindly. I don't ever know the subject. I don't just listen to radio or watch TV. But, hey, you know, America, listen up. We have to stand up, you know, for ourselves. And the thing is, you know, we have to give America back to the Americans. What we need to do is this, guys. Listen up. Stop buying foreign products, man. Fortify America commercially. Close these dang borders to foreigners to come in here and do what they want in school and everything like that. I mean, I know guys who are going to medical school who can barely speak English, who do not have to take English classes, you know. And we have to close the borders. We have to make America like an autonomous nation. That's the problem. That's what's going on. We've given out and given up and, oh, hey, let's just be this red, white, and blue and pink nation and, like, have a rainbow and be all cool to everybody else. But you know what? Meanwhile, America is suffering economically, industrially, you know? I mean, Ron, I don't expect you to retort to this a whole lot. I hope, man, America and Detroit stands, you know, up to this, because Detroit is one of the places, the economies that have been affected most by what Ron is talking about.
Well, you know, closing the borders is a really complicated topic, and you know, I don't really want to go into that whole thing right now, but there was something interesting on 60 Minutes last night. What's the guy that wants to be the governor? He's real outspoken, bold. His name is Kiki. I can't remember his last name, but he, you know, the two things that he wants to do if he's governor of Texas is close the borders and fight for better education. So,
well, I'll tell you what, you know, Ron, I used to live in the Southwest, and I'll tell you what, I talked to guys out in the Southwest, and, you know, I'm a blue-collar guy, and there's a reason why people want to close the borders, like in Texas. They mess with our even minimum wage, because these cats will come over from Mexico, you know, the hot blast, and you know, hey, I work for $2 an hour. What's that? Come on. You know, we Americans, we've settled upon, you know, what's minimum wage? I don't make it. God, thank God I don't make it. Well, how much is minimum wage? Like $5.60 an hour?
I think that's about what I make.
We should be ashamed. We don't even know that, Rhonda. Come on. Look,
little joke.
We're Americans. We don't even know what our brothers are, like, struggling at. And this is the point. This is the point. You know?
All right, Nick. Well, we really appreciate you calling, and thanks for your thoughts and your opinions, and thanks for calling Night Call.
Hey, America, call back.
All right. My name is Kelly Brown. This is Night Call. I'm sitting in for Peter Werby. Let's go to the phones. Looks like we have John, who is in Baton Rouge. Hey, John, what's going on? As soon as I learn how to work the phone system here, we'll
Hello?
Be just fine. Hi there, John. What's up?
Not too much. I'm not calling from Baton Rouge. I'm calling from Westland.
Oh, you're calling from Westland.
Yeah, here's the thing. What do you think about the mayor of Baton Rouge there about Chocolate Town and all that good stuff?
Well, you know, I think that the rebuttal, I was watching Anderson Cooper on CNN the other day.
Sure.
And I think that I didn't hear the whole thing. I was in the studio here working, but I think the rebuttal was he said something about, you know, I don't know what I was saying, or I was out of my head, or he didn't mean it that way.
He was trying to retract.
Yeah, yeah. So, I don't know. I think that was probably not the smartest thing for him to say, but I understand that he wants to stick up for his people in the same way.
I see. Can I make another comment?
Sure.
Credit cards. I had a credit card like 10 years ago. I had three at one time, and this thing had a credit line of $3,000. And I ultimately paid it off because I was in debt, and I went to Battle Creek for 8 years. But I don't have a cell phone or a credit card or checking account. I paid cash for my car. I'm a disabled vet, and my brother is my conservator, and he has all my finances and stuff. But credit cards are excellent.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a whole other side of it. Wow. Yeah, and you know what? When I can use them, I love them too.
you know what's really good about credit cards? Like if you got a $1,000 limit and your car's in the shop for $300, you just put the credit card down there and they fix it and you're all set.
Right.
Or like when you're stuck on the freeway and you have to pay $50 for the tow, you got the credit card.
Right. And you know, you're absolutely right. It saves you from being situation where your back is up against the wall where you don't have any money and you need your car fixed because you need your car to get to work, right? So, all right, well, listen, John, thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, we'll talk to you later. This is Night Call. I'm Kelly Brown in for Peter Werby. Thanks for hanging out. We're talking about credit card bills. Are you stuck? Let's go to the phones. We're talking to Julie in Redford. Is that right? Julie in Redford.
Actually, it's Julian.
Julian. Hi, Julian. Welcome to Night Call.
Well, this is kind of ironic because you guys are sitting there preaching the benefits of having a credit card when you're in a pinch, but then if you're in a pinch, you're saying, hey, screw the credit card companies. They're the last people we need to worry about.
Well,
it kind of gets, and believe me, I am no Republican, and I lean a little more towards Peter than Wall Street Journal, but it's all about personal responsibility. I mean, people are buying houses on interest-only loans, and they're, going to the malls and shooting up their credit cards, and then, yeah, they get in a pinch, and you're saying, hey, screw the credit card companies. They're not very important.
No, I'm not saying screw the credit card companies. I'm just saying, what do we do with the people that do have their backs up against the wall, that do lose their jobs, that are forced to use the credit cards because they have nothing else to do? I'm not saying screw the credit card companies. I'm just saying, what do we do? And actually, they're about ready to hike the rates again, and they can do whatever the hell they want to. So, well, I mean, what do we do? We're in that. The both sides of the coin. Credit cards are good, and if you are a responsible adult and you make your payments, they're all good. But what do we do when we're in the situation where they're maxed out and the rates keep going up? We're never going to get our head above water.
Well, most people, and I'm not going to say all people because you got to qualify things, and that's why you had a pretty open-ended statement on your intro there, which is what made me call. But most people who are heads underwater, have done a few things to get themselves there.
Right.
I'm not going to say all, and by no means, a whole ton, but a lot of them anyway. And I'm in the same boat everybody else is. I just had to have a root canal. It cost me $1,500, and I don't have insurance.
Oh,
boy. I had to get it done, And so I'm dealing with it. And I'm self-employed, but the thing is, I'm not, I don't know. There's a lot of spending habits where there's today's society is a very consumerism society, and I didn't really say that right, but too much buying. And don't get me wrong, I buy a lot of stuff too, but you've got to know what's buying, whether or not what you're buying is going to get you anything at the end.
You have to be able to be responsible and think it through. Am I going to be able to pay for this? Am I going to be able to afford this $500,000 house? You have to be able to be responsible and think it through before you get your
I'm driving a 98. My house, cost me 69, and now it's worth 130. So cool for me, but I'm not jumping up to go get a $300,000 house because the rates were at 4%. And now all of a sudden I'm in a pinch. People who get in a pinch all of a sudden, if it's not due to family members or themselves and illnesses and such, chances are they're in a pinch because they weren't doing, smart things to begin with.
Absolutely.
And the thing is, everybody out there who's listening, and you yourself and me myself perhaps, has tried to help somebody who is down and out of their luck. And sometimes that help works and other times it doesn't, because you've got somebody who's just got a history of being down and on their luck because of the decisions they make.
Right, absolutely.
And there is no answer, and I didn't come with an answer. I'm just saying your first statement was, if you've got to pay your bills and support your family, then forgive. You know, well, it's like everybody's paying their bills and supporting their family.
Right.
But some people are doing things a little smarter than others. And other people, you know, get out of work at 4 and sit down and have a beer and, you know, watch the game on Sunday instead of going out and making more money, you know.
Right. That's true. Instead
of always the answers, but, you know, it's there's something to be said for capitalism and there's something to be said for entrepreneurship. And I suppose there's something to be said for socialism, but then there's something not to be said for it, because the minute you eliminate people having to help themselves, you take away, you know, I think it's been shown, I mean, I'm no history buff, but it's got to have been shown that, you know, you take away initiative and, you know, and people start sitting around, you know.
Wow. You know what? You have a very strong outlook and a very confident delivery. I really appreciate you calling today because you gave us another outlook. All right?
Well, somebody's probably going to tear me down. But
No.
And I appreciate the show.
No. Thanks a lot, Julian from Redford. We have a couple of things to take care of, and we'll be back with more of your calls. 101 WRIF. I'm Kelly Brown in for Peter Werby this week, and this is Night Call.
You're listening to WRIF.com. Ready to party in paradise with the Poobah?
Back with a heart attack.
Celebrating 20 years of Maui Time.
101 Riff and Budweiser are proud to present Maui Time 2006.
The concept.
Ready for some fun in the sun?
How'd you like to spend a week with the sunshine, the crystal blue water, and the black sands of Kahanapali Beach in Maui?
Why don't you tell him the whole story?
Then just listen for those three magic words.
Not yet!
Now listen carefully for the directions.
When you hear them, be Motor City Caller 34 on the Rip Line.
And pack your bags, baby.
You and a guest could be getting the hell out of the cold. Partying with Arthur P. and the Riff in Maui. Maui Time, 2006.
20 years of Riff. Tradition continues.
For Budweiser, this is Budweiser, this is beer. At 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Baby!
WRIF.com.
Amanda Michael.
Ah, so I'm guessing you're a very busy person then, right, Amanda?
No, just Amanda. Straight that time. Whoops. My friends even started calling me Demanda.
How flattering. So, Demanda, On Demand from Comcast is perfect for you because...
I know what I want and what I want to watch when I want to watch it.
Yeah, all you have to do is press a button and there they are. Tons of free programs that you can pause, play, and rewind whenever you want. Free On Demand. You won't get that from a satellite dish.
Right. Small thank you to take mine down for me. Right now?
Right now.
It's very unsightly.
Wow, you are demanding. Get superior picture and sound, tons of free on-demand programs, and more. Only with Comcast Digital Cable. Now just $39.99 a month for 4 months. Just call 1-888-COMCAST.
New customers only. After promotional period, regular charges apply. Installation, taxes, and franchise fees are not included. On-demand programs are limited, and some are subject to charge. Other restrictions apply. Limited time off.
Yes, this is your little reminder that you made a resolution last year. You remember, right? You were resolved to start eating healthy and get back into shape. The resolution you blew off last year. The resolution you'll make again. Don't blow it off any longer. Hardcore Fitness is here to help you. They're your partner in physical fitness with competitive membership plans and no pushy salespeople. On your way to or from work, Hardcore Fitness is on 13 Mile and Little Mac in Roseville with direct access to I-94. Featuring celebrity trainer Clay Hudson, who's worked in the music industry for 10 years, including some of the artists you hear on the Riff. From yoga and Pilates, 30-minute lunchtime workouts, to personalized boot camp style training. Hardcore Fitness honors our nation's heroes with discounted memberships for active military, reservists, and guardsmen, active duty police, and firefighters. For a limited time, Hardcore Fitness is offering special grand opening deals starting at just 56 cents per day. Fitness has never been so affordable. Call 586-203-8224 or log on hardcorefitness.com. That's hardcore, like the Marine Corps, HardCorpFitness.com. Or call 586-203-8224.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Well, Peter is in Caracas, Venezuela this week, and next week, actually. I'm Kelly Brown, sitting in for him. We're talking about credit cards and all kinds of things to do with credit cards. You know, we're not just saying credit card companies suck, because they do have their advantages. But, you know, with these rate hikes and in the economy and people losing their jobs and whatever do we do to catch up and keep paying those bills with the interest rates hiking constantly? It's just very, very frustrating. You know, it shouldn't take you 20 years to pay off a $1,700 credit card bill. But Julian from Westland was right. We have to be responsible as well. So there's all sides, all different sides of the coin, that we need to look at here. Let's go to another call. Let's talk to, Roy, who is in New Mexico. Hi, Roy.
The town tonight. Anyway.
No, what did you just say?
pardon me?
We missed what you said because I can't, frickin' figure out how to work the phones yet.
Oh, I had forgotten things going south for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Doing a good job filling in.
Thank you.
I enjoy your enthusiasm.
Thank you. Thank you.
I want to fuss a little bit about what Julian said. Number one, when I hear this responsibility crap, all I know is they've been listening to Limbaugh too long. Because that's the buzzword. That's the buzzword.
Are you saying that you think that what he said is coming from somebody that's never struggled?
Yeah, I kind of tend to think that, maybe. But that, and I don't want to get off on that a little bit, but it's just that big buzzword. Got to take responsibility. Got to take responsibility. Which I agree. And most people do after they've kind of gotten hit. You know, I think all young people have credit cards to a certain extent. I had a deal a month or two ago where I missed putting I put a 2 cent stamp on instead of a 37 cent stamp. And my payment was late. You know what it cost me?
What?
$58 in late charges and interest pay. And it was. And I pay my bill every month. I never carry a balance. But I had some pretty heavy travel, and I rolled up about a $3,000 balance. It was about 4 days late.
Wow.
$29 late fee. $32 worth of interest fees. Now, because I had, you know, clear credit and everything else, they took it off. But that was $52 for 4 days late. Now, was I responsible? Yeah, hell, I was responsible. Was I careless? Yeah, I stuck it in. I picked up a stamp instead of the right stamp. I picked up a fancy 2 cent stamp that I thought was the 37 cent stamp.
Yeah, you know what? They're usually pretty.
But how can people bail themselves out with those? Forget the interest payment. Just $28, $30 a month in late fee for 4 days late. Give me a break.
Yeah.
And I wonder how many of those 30,000 Ford employees lose their job tomorrow.
Oh, God, I was just thinking about that.
Now, how about them? The guy's responsible. He's got a job. He's been with Ford for 15 years. He's got his own house, got his kids in college. He's doing this. He's doing that. Hey, you know, whatever. And all of a sudden he's got $3,000-$4,000 on a credit card that he's been comfortably making the payments on.
Right.
And all of a sudden, no job.
Now, that's what I say, and I'm talking to. I was talking to a lady this week that I know, and she said that she has been living off her credit cards for probably the last 6 months.
Julian talked about his root canal, no insurance. Well, if he doesn't have insurance, how would it have been had he been in an accident? He was self-employed. Let's say he broke his leg and wasn't able to work 6 weeks. How's he going to pay for that? Is that responsible? Number one, is it responsible to not have insurance? I don't know. But what happens if he has an accident and is laid up for 6 or 8 weeks with no income coming in? How about during the controversy with the bankruptcy when the congressman sold out to the credit card companies? The credit card companies wrote the bills. 50% of the people that file bankruptcy do so because of medical expenses, and the vast, vast majority of them had insurance.
They had insurance.
Had insurance and still had to go broke.
Medical bills are there whether you have health insurance or not. You know,
that's right.
It definitely makes it more rough if you don't have health insurance. I had to deal with that this year. Prescription drugs are so expensive if you don't have health insurance. And it's
well,
just
they're expensive if you got health insurance.
Well,
because
yeah,
you're paying for the health insurance.
Yeah, that's true. That's
so
true.
I mean, it's like, no, wait a second. We're in this whole thing, and the thing that just kind of teed me off was his throwing around that term. People got to take responsibility. Well, I don't think there's 98% of the people are gonna say that people need to take responsibility. 75 to 80% of the time, everybody is going to be taking responsibility. There's going to be times where people get just careless.
Right.
But that's, and most of that, it's part of growing up, quite frankly. But you hear, I don't know if you've ever heard Bruce Williams on the radio. You know, Uncle Bruce, financial guy. But so many times people would be calling in their young, early 20s that made a few mistakes and are $10,000, $20,000 in hock and getting farther behind just because they can't keep up with the minimum payments.
Right.
So, you know, even if they could just make the minimum payments without the interest or without the penalties for being over max and all of these other kinds of fees.
Right, that's what I'm talking about.
It's a racket. I mean, when I was growing up in Chicago in the 50s and 60s, the loan sharks didn't get as much as the credit card companies.
And January 31st, they're going to hike them up again. Well,
that's
Roy,
right.
Roy, how's the weather in New Mexico today?
Actually, it's kind of chilly tonight.
It is.
Beautiful.
All right.
Not
well,
enough snow.
Thanks.
No snow at all.
Thanks so much for calling, Roy.
You betcha.
All right.
Have a good one. Take care.
This is Night Call, and I'm Kelly Brown. We're talking about the credit card bills. We're talking about a lot of things. What's on your mind? Hey, let's go to the phones. Donna is in Chesterfield Township. What's up, Donna?
My husband, credit cards helped me. My husband had a heart attack. When I was in need of help, credit cards were there. I'm a 50 girl and I'm 46 years old. And now I'm struggling paying 29.99% interest.
29?
Yeah. And I'm freaking because everything I pay is, well, a dollar goes to it. I'm really scared. Now I'm paying for my health insurance too, which scares me now. And I'm paying health insurance and I'm basically making minimum wage. Back to minimum wage. And I thought one time I was really important, but I don't know anymore.
Well, you're just barely keeping your head above water, right?
Yeah, I'm struggling.
Well, you know,
but you have to.
Yeah, you have absolutely. What are you going to do? You can't just sit down and just say I can't take it anymore. You absolutely have to move forward, and you have to keep going, and just hope for things to get better. You know, and Roy was right that just called from New Mexico. Look at all these people that have been at Ford for 15, 20 years are waiting on their fate tomorrow. See if they're going to lose their job. So you know what? Concentrate on the positives. At least you have a job, and you know, at least you have health insurance. Because believe me,
$12 an hour I make. So
well,
I'm doing.
That's more than me.
Oh my God! High five, girl.
All right, Donna. Thanks for calling.
All right, take care.
All right, this is Night Call. I'm Kelly Brown. Thanks for listening to the Riff and Night Call. Peter Werby will be back in 2 weeks from tonight. Okay, let's go to the phones once again. Ed is in Imlay City. Hello, Ed. What's on your mind?
I was calling. Pretty much, I'm going to talk a little bit from the side of the coin where I am basically in debt right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't seem to really bother me. When collectors and so on and so forth call about it, I pretty much tell the one with the lowest debt, excuse me, to wait in line. But what I've noticed
How
is,
old are you, Ed?
I'm 23.
Okay, so what do they tell you when you say wait in line?
They get pretty rude. I mean, you know, you hear, and honestly, like, when you hear, like, ads for mortgage and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff on late night TV about how collectors call and they're very rude. They actually are very, very unethically rude.
Have you ever had somebody ask you if you say, well, you know what? I don't have any money. I can't pay you this month. And they say, well, can you borrow it? Like you haven't already thought of that, you know?
Yeah. And I refuse not to. You know, I just try to keep a steady job. And, you know, if that doesn't work out, I just keep trying. And I just, you know, just try to push the stress off and say, well, you know, I'll pay you when I can, but, you know, and if they try to charge anything more, then okay, whatever. They'll see it when they see it.
Yeah, and you know what? That's like the best attitude to have, because somebody said to me this week, well, you know what? If I don't have it, I don't have it.
Yeah.
What that's are you going to do? You're going to stress yourself out to death, you know?
And you know, on a legal front, I know that it's not going to incur you in a bad way, because it's, you know, you're not legally obligated to pay anybody, you know, legally, you know, like they can try and take you to civil court, and what ends up going to happen is you can go to court and waste even more money when they pull you in there and subpoena you in there, and then you're just going to tell the judge, hey, I don't have the money, and the judge is going to say, well, how much do you make? And it's going to be a fight for them to try to garnish your wages,
right?
You know. But my original purpose to calling in is, as I've noticed throughout my high school years, is they teach you, I mean, that's all I really went through because I went through a skilled trade, but through high school, I noticed they only teach you for either pre-college or career-based fundamentals. Only one class can I say that I could give credit to, which I think we called singles, taught you how to balance your checkbook. So in a capitalistic union, nobody is teaching you how to, I guess, be a capitalist and be very money management oriented. You know, you get out of high school, you're like, okay, I either A, go to college, or A, get a steady job, and then I try to make it that way. But last time I checked, you know, when I got out of high school, I was like a lost sheep, you know. I'm either learning my financial situations from my parents, or I'm just learning it just like one day at a time, like, okay, wait, what do I do here? And I've noticed that with a lot of people who get in debt is that they're uneducated by the fact on how to manage money in the first place.
Right, and you know what is interesting that you said that you're 23, you seem like you're pretty responsible. I saw, and I can't remember where I saw it this week, but they did a news story about kids in college that their parents are just paying their bills. Some of these kids, teenagers were asked, well, do you know how this situation works, or do you know when to pay your bill, or do you know what your interest rate is? And they said they have no idea about any of that. They just use the credit card and the parent takes care of everything.
Yep. And those are the poorest people in the U.S., to be honest, from experience with my friend, or a lot of my friends that go to college, that, you know, besides the ones that are having everything paid for, they're still the poorest people I know.
Wow. Well, I think you need to start somewhere with responsibility as far as, there's that R word again, sorry. All right, well, Ed, in Imlay City, thank you for joining the program tonight. Thanks a lot. I have some other calls to take care of. This is Night Call. Thanks for hanging out with me tonight. I'm Kelly Brown, sitting in for the first time. A little overwhelming for the first time, but you guys will help me through that, won't you? All right, let's go to Daryl in Detroit. He wants to talk about credit cards. Hey, Daryl, what's going on?
Hey, how you doing? You're doing a great job. Don't worry about it.
Thank you very much.
Big fan of Peter's show.
Great.
I got in credit card debt in my early 20s. My main source of credit card debt was I tried to help somebody that was very close to with a large sum of money, and they bailed on me.
And
I was stuck, and then I lost my job, and da-da-da. Okay. So I had two credit cards at the time that were like $500 limit ones, but the one I let my buddy use, tried to help him with, was a very large sum of money that I should never have had access to. And it's very ironic that the Bush administration keeled over for the credit card companies when their methods are as unethical as you get. Let me give you one. When you're 19 years old, I was 19 getting credit cards sent to me like crazy.
Yeah, they do that.
How can you send people with no credit? First of all, when you're 19, 20, you're a retard. I don't care what anyone says. You're a retard when it comes to life, how money works, interest rates, all that stuff. I was the dumb kid. I mean, I wasn't, you know, uneducated or anything like that, but you think, oh, well, I did this, I pay it back. You know, it's a big, it's just fun. It's free money, and you pay a little here, you pay a little there. You know, you only keep yourself at a certain limit. And I was responsible. But like I said, I tried to help someone out, and I got in a major pinch, which I'm still in to this day. And I'm actually in the process of having a consolidator work with my credit card companies to get my rates down and to do, you know, that route, because I can't handle just having them out there anymore, because I'm paying minimum payments and I'm getting nowhere. And I found out some things through talking to them and dealing with them of the unethical things that they do. First of all, credit card companies, for some reason or another, have access to your other credit card companies. And if you pay late, let's say I paid late on a Sears card, and let's say I have Capital One. Capital One can say, oh, he paid late on his Sears card. Well, that means he might pay us late. We're going to hike his interest rates up, and they can legally do it. All that fine print, they don't count on you reading that. PBS did an amazingly revealing story on them. And they basically said, you know, why don't people know about all these little things you do, da da da? And they're like, well, we don't want to confuse people; they wouldn't understand. That's what the guy said.
Well, no, and you know, it's
crazy.
It's true. It's just madness. I know it's absolutely madness. But the thing is that there is so much fine print, and I think they count on people. Really, most people are not going to read all of the fine print. So, you know, and people are like, woohoo, credit card, you know, let's go. And they don't, like I was talking to Julian in Westland, people really sometimes just don't think the whole thing through.
Well, he really upset me, because it's like most people I know about seven people with a lot of credit card debt, okay? They're all college bills. All college bills. When you're in college and you've got a $3,000 credit card and you're making minimum wage and you can't eat or go out and you're studying, you can't afford this book or that book. You know, I only know one person in my life that got themselves in trouble because they were shopaholics. It is not the norm. It is what they like to put out there, like, oh, irresponsible people in their shopaholic ways. It's people with medical bills, college bills, and people who get desperate and that's all they have, like the person you mentioned. And to sit here and say personal responsibility, it's just madness to me, and it really upset me. So you take care, have a good night, and good job tonight.
Thank you, Daryl. Have a good night. All right, this is a Night Call. I'm Kelly Brown, and we have a couple of things to take care of, and we will go back to the phones in just a few minutes. So stay there, okay?
This is Night
Call. This is WRIF.com.
And
now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, One Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Enter? The Riff Street Team is appearing at job sites around town from January 3rd through the 27th so you can register. Or go to WRIF.com.
Easy enough.
We're rendering?
Sure.
Great. Oh, and if your lunchbox starts talking, ignore it.
Michigan Cat Toolbox Tournament 2006. And throughout January, Hooters is visiting local job sites to honor hardworking construction workers. You can stop by Hooters of Troy, Novi, Roseville, Sterling Heights, and Taylor today, where the world-famous Hooters girls are serving up nearly world-famous chicken wings.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Peter is in Caracas, Venezuela for the next 2 weeks at a convention, and he just might call us one of these days. So So that would be kind of cool. I'm Kelly Brown. This is Night Call. Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF Detroit. We're talking about credit cards. We're talking about all kinds of stuff tonight. Credit card fees, different things. So something on your mind, 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to the phones. We have Jim on the line, and Jim is driving around in Cleveland, Ohio. What's on your mind, Jim?
Hello.
Hi there. Good. How are you?
Good. You're doing real well.
Thank you.
I think you're doing real good.
Thank you.
Reason you had me wanting to call you is I went through a situation where I went without work for 18 months, and maybe even a little longer than that. And I was married at the time, with two children, a home, you know, the normal life, and I did pay all my bills on time. When I went out of work, when I lost work, I couldn't find work. I did anything to hustle money, but it wasn't enough. I found out by calling the credit card companies and explaining my situation to them, they actually were receptive in the sense that they understood I had no income. And what they did was they told me, they gave me a number to call, and they told me to call this number and let them know the situation. You just have to communicate with them.
Yeah, a lot of people are afraid and they avoid, you know?
That's it, exactly. They're afraid to communicate with them. And when you don't talk to someone and you owe them money, all they can do is assume. And people are, you know, human nature, we assume the worst.
Right, right, right.
You know? Another thing, I really want to stress this. Your past couple callers hit on something real important. We have no base of education on how money works, okay? They teach you in school. They teach you in college. They teach you all the way, you know, being raised through high school and so on and so forth, how to make money, okay? But they don't teach you how money actually works. I really think that we need to change our educational system in a big way, but basically we should teach a lot of economics, world economics, and you know, just how the United States works, you know, and our money. And people have to understand it. Once you get out there and start earning money, that doesn't mean you should go out and spend money right away. If you talk to somebody who's really wealthy, what they do is they get to a position in their savings and money they put away to where their money works for them instead of that they work, you know, instead of they're working for money.
Right, it's not that, you know, they say sometimes when people have money, oh, that guy's really cheap, he won't let a penny go to save his life, but, you know, he probably just manages well and knows how to, you know, knows how to work money.
Yeah,
and
he understands how money works, but I think if we started teaching this in our high schools, you know, maybe from freshman year on.
As a requirement.
Yeah, as a requirement that you know, maybe even make up like here, everybody has an imaginary $5,000. And at the end of the year, you know, see who's ahead and see who's behind, you know, and not really grade them, you know, pass or fail, just to teach them how money actually works.
That's a very smart idea. Are you what do you do for a living, Jim?
I'm a driver.
You should be a teacher.
You know, I've been told that, but, you know, I have a problem with people are, to me, I don't know, they're just, don't get me wrong, I'm a people person, but I have a very low tolerance of bull crap, so to speak.
Right, that's why I'm in a little studio all by myself.
Well, I think you do a real good job. I've listened to you for a number of years, you know. And when you left that other station, I tried to find where you went, and I was so happy when I heard you one day.
Thank you very much.
I actually live in Cleveland, but I drive into Detroit.
Well, it was definitely their loss.
Yeah.
All right, Jim.
You're doing an excellent job, and keep it up.
Thank you very much, Jim. I appreciate your opinion. All right. My name is Kelly Brown. This is Night Call. I'm in for Peter Werby for the next 2 weeks. Thank you for hanging out. Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF. Stan is in Garden City. And, Stan, what's going on? Let me pull him up here. I'll get it. Hey, Stan, what's going on?
Hey, good evening, Kelly. How
are
you doing tonight?
Good, thank you.
My issues are twofold. One would be tapping off on quality of life you've been discussing tonight. The second one would be the prices of oil and Iran, actually. But I'll talk about the first issue, our quality of life, which is decreased in Michigan and is going south across the border to who knows where. Our national poverty rate, if you can't live above $18,000 a year, then you're not going to make it. That's one problem for people trying to pay their credit cards off.
Mm-hmm.
Interest rates are, well, whoever gets a credit card, they're a genius on that. Anybody's an expert because I can't figure it out anymore. I guess with the last caller who talked about the economics and everything, you're going back to Bush's voodoo economics with his father and beyond that. It's a whole new ball game. We're never coming out of this economic depression that we're in. I'm nervous. I'm unemployed now, and my unemployment's running out. It's really sad on how Michigan economy's gone to nothing now. And I guess my second issue would be Iran, and crude oil is supposed to top off at $100 a barrel from what I read on the internet and Yahoo.
What's it at right now?
Oh, about 70-something.
Mm.
Now, the problem I got with this, I got a letter from my congressman, Thaddeus McCotter, and I really urge the people out there, regardless if you're Republican or Democrat, I'm Democrat myself, but, you know, there are good Republicans out there. You just got to try and deal with these people. They're hard-headed, but there are good tax-paying Republicans out there. You know, the problem is with politicians. I mean, with all this corporate greed up there and corruption, you don't know who to trust. But I guess what I'm reading from my congressman, they have introduced a House Resolution 152, which is urging to have Iran comply with nuclear sanctions. And if they don't, then Iran's playing the card to blackmail the United States and who else is riding the oil train to raise the price of $100 a barrel. It's not looking good. And to be honest with you, it's looking more like we're going to be in a devastated position in this country for a long time. And I'll leave the rest of the time to the callers and for you to elaborate on what I said. But we really need to pray on all faiths here. It's not coming back, this country, and this state's not coming back here. It's
oh, Stan, that's so depressing.
It's the God's truth.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your call.
Goodbye.
This is Night Call, and wow. You guys. All right. Well, we have another phone caller, Tim. And what's on your mind, Tim?
Yeah, Kelly, hi.
Tim is in Toronto.
No, I'm not in Toronto, but that's where I'm from.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm just actually driving home. Interesting show you've got on tonight. I've never actually called a radio station before, but my wife and I were down on our way down to Cobo Hall today, and one of the things we were talking about was pensions and money management and your previous caller's comment about not being taught in school
mm-hmm.
how to manage money. Just phenomenal. It's a shame because people do get in trouble, and it's you know, it's no different in Canada. And you know, several of our friends struggle with that same problem with credit, and as have I, and many others. So
yeah, everybody I know has got some kind of money issue at this point. You know, I don't know that, you know, anybody doesn't. I mean, whether it's credit card or just, you know, overspending or not having enough money or the holidays set you back or, you know, whatever. It's just that everybody's got some kind of issue right now. You know, and I'm sure it's wrapped up in a lot of different reasons because, you know, because of the economy and because, all the, you know, so many auto workers have lost their jobs and pray for those guys tomorrow at Ford that they don't lose their jobs and they don't close that Wixom plant. Or it's the hiking oil prices. I mean, it hits everybody. You know, the thing is, too, with gas prices and related to the economy, you see the gas prices are rising and you see that, you know, the credit card rates are rising. But, you know, nobody's really getting a raise out there. You know, I mean, it makes it more difficult to manage your money when you've got more coming out than you have coming in, you know? So
it's almost out of control. And, you know, I really feel for those people, and it you know, it hits all of us.
So everybody, go into work tomorrow and just say, hey, you know what? The cost of living is going nuts. Can I have a raise, please? Come on, it's only fair, boss. you know?
Yeah, like that's going to happen.
Yeah, I know. Well, just wishful thinking, I guess. All right, Tim, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you, Kelly. Have a good evening.
All right, you as well. This is Night Call, and I'm Kelly Brown. 10 minutes after 12 o'clock. We have another, about 45 minutes to go yet. So if you have something on your mind, 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to Tim, let's go to Rob. Rob, what's on your mind? This is Night Call. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. What I want to point out is regarding this debt situation. Welcome to the third world. This is what happens with a group of people who don't pay attention to politics. They, usually dismiss it, or maybe they're Republicans and they like the way they think. Now you see what this country and other advanced countries have been doing to third world countries now for decades. This is the debt trap. You're in it, and I'm going to warn people. It's going to get worse. You had a caller who talked about putting sanctions on Iran. I can't think of a more wrong-headed situation. Here's a guy who does not pay attention to what's going on. He reads the wrong people. Maybe he listens to Rush Limbaugh and the rest of those scumbags from the right. Iran is not doing anything wrong. There shouldn't be any sanctions on Iran. And let me tell you, it's your own government that is pushing the oil prices up. That's right. And listen to how it works, because I'm going to tell you something that you only read in economic magazines, which most people avoid because they don't pay attention. The United States government gets a huge loan from the entire world by making sure that oil is priced in dollars. Now, Peter has touched on this in the past, but he never really goes into enough detail so that your audience understands clearly and succinctly why the United States government engages in policies, foreign policy, that actually increases the price of oil and screws its own citizens as well as the rest of the world, except for the very rich. Let me tell you how it works. When you have dollars priced in oil, as we do for the most part all across the globe, people have to acquire dollars in some fashion. They have to sell things to the United States. Bear with me. Now, when the United States gets itself in trouble, as it is in now, and as Nixon did in 71, when he ran up the deficit, like our idiot president is doing now, the dollar plummeted in value. There was a real crisis, and there's a crisis now. The dollar is a worthless currency. That's the first thing for Americans to understand. And it isn't based on the gold situation. It's based on the fact that they simply have a huge debt. The country is, like many of its citizens, completely bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the government is under extreme pressure. If you've been paying attention at all, you see gold prices are going up, commodity prices are going up, despite the fact that the United States government, the British, all the advanced countries are doing everything they can to suppress these gold prices by using a lot of unscrupulous dealings in the market. But the gold price continues to go up. Why? Because people have no confidence in the dollar. Foreign creditors like China, Japan, Germany, Russia, other countries are now starting to dump dollars. You don't read this unless you read the financial papers. So most Americans just turn their eyes up and ignore it. Big mistake. What's happening is when people don't want to hold dollars anymore, you've got a big problem. You can't continue to borrow. The United States is broke. What does it do? It jacks the price of oil up. When the price of oil goes up, then all those countries that must buy oil, and that's practically all of them except for the big producers, they must all go out and scurry and get dollars. When they demand dollars, the price of dollar rises in the currency market so that it has a higher value relative to other currencies. This is not abstract stuff. This works right in your pocketbook every day. When people don't understand it, they're going to continue to get screwed.
Okay, so you're saying that people should... can you turn your radio down just a little bit?
What?
Can you turn your radio down just a little bit?
My radio's not on.
Oh, all right. Well, forget that. So what do you think is going to happen January 31st when they have this big meeting and they're going to hike up the credit card rates again, the interest rates, or the credit card rates? Now, what exactly are we to do? Now, I was talking earlier about people's back being against the wall, but you how are you going to pay off the credit card when they're going to jack it up again? And I guess my point is, I'm sorry, I'm rambling a little bit. How are they allowed to do this?
Well, I'd be glad to answer that, but I need to wrap up what I said, otherwise people are going to be left dangling because I didn't get the point. We invaded Iraq for a number of reasons, but one of them was because Saddam Hussein was going to price his oil in euros. That was his right, and it was a good thing for Iraq to do. The United States could not stand that because it would threaten the dollar. Now, we simply can't have this kind of imperialism where we go around invading countries because they want to run their business in a way that isn't in alignment with us. Iran is doing the same thing. Iran is going to open an oil burst, an oil trading commodities operation in its own country sometime in March, which, by the way, coincides with the very time when the United States and Israel are threatening to invade it. Iran wants to price in euros. This, again, we are. So what the first thing people have to do, more important than their credit card debt, is to stop this next war against Iran. We are technically already at war with Iran. Whether people know it or not, we are inside doing covert ops, which are absolutely illegal and an act of war. So we have already initiated war thanks to our idiot president and the American people who have not restrained this president.
Okay, Rob, you're obviously very strong in the things that you believe in. How are you proactive in your beliefs?
All right, if you want to understand how bad things are, you're not going to solve this problem, and you're not going to solve the credit card problem and the oil price problem and the horrible aggressive foreign policy of this country, which is about to, we're going to do nuclear war on Iran. Do you understand that, Kelly? They are threatening to use all-out nuclear bombs on Iran. This is outrageous, and it cannot be allowed to happen. Now, it will send oil prices up to $500 a barrel, and it that will, of course, save the dollar, but it will destroy practically everybody but the ultra-rich.
Absolutely.
Now, here's what needs to be done. You're not going to solve this problem through normal electoral politics. The voting machines are rigged. The Republicans are in control. They prevent people from voting. We know that there are three elections have been stolen. The three previous elections have been stolen. 2000, 2002, and 2004, all stolen elections. There's no doubt about it. People will have to use the same mechanism that has been used successfully in Latin and South America. What this country has never done before, but other people have done it, and it's worked. They have gotten rid of their hideous governments through a general strike and a buying boycott. And it may be also necessary for people to stop paying their federal income tax. We have to completely shut this thing down and then submit the demands to this government and just continue to be on strike until, in fact, they meet every last demand. Those demands can include forgiveness of debts and penalties and so forth. You have to take this country back, and that means we're going to have to use extraordinary acts of civil disobedience in order to achieve it.
Okay, Rob, I appreciate your call. We've got to move on and take some more calls. So thank you very much.
Bye for now.
All right. This is Night Call, and I'm Kelly Brown. Oh, man, he's stressing me out. Very strong-minded. 18 minutes after 12 o'clock. Hello, I'm Kelly Brown, sitting in for Peter Werby. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Let's take another phone call. Hi, what's on your mind tonight?
Hi.
Hi, this is Night Call. What's on your mind?
Oh, wow. I got through.
Who's this?
I wasn't expecting to be on. I appreciate a lot of what that guy said earlier. I think he's got to kind of watch his tone. It sounds more like he's speaking at people rather than...
Right.
But,
maybe it's just the passion.
I'm very passionate, too. I appreciate what he said about civil disobedience. I think we really got to start, I guess, all the concerned citizens out there really have to get to going, and that's kind of why I called. I want to say a lot of people that are calling that sound like they're very concerned about pretty much the state of the workers in the country and, you know, so on. And I wanted to mention that there is a protest tomorrow at the Delphi headquarters in Troy,
okay,
starting at 2. And that I think everyone that's concerned with the state of the country, the price of oil and all this stuff, it's all related. And that if you really want to start seeing some change, I think you have to do more than just vote Democrat and expect everything to change. You got to start taking action.
That's why I asked this last guy. I mean, he seems like he had, you know, a lot on his mind, and he was, you know, real passionate about the country and a lot of things. But I wanted to know why, what he was doing. you know, to back up all these beliefs and what he was doing to be proactive as far as, you know, taking the first step. What do you do if you're an individual? It's very frustrating. You know, you attend protests like this one tomorrow. Is it a general protest, or is it an anti-war protest, or what is it?
It's a protest to support GM Delphi workers against their union taking concessions. It's organized by a rank-and-file organization called Soldiers of Solidarity. They recently had a protest over at it was the first day of the International Auto Show over at Hart.
I saw that.
And this is kind of a, version 2 electric boogaloo kind of over at the Delphi headquarters. So if you're concerned, get out there, scream and yell at these guys because, don't scream and yell at the protesters at the, you know.
Do you work for GM?
Excuse me?
Do you work for GM?
I do not. I'm just a concerned citizen, labor sympathizer. Much like, I guess, you know, Peter is and a lot of the people that are calling tonight. So get out there and, you know, let the guys know what's up.
Hey, what's your name?
Aaron.
Where are you calling from?
I'm just driving on 96 right now, going home from Detroit.
All right. Well, thanks for listening to The Riff, and thanks for calling Night Call.
Yeah, no problem. Talk to you later.
All right. Hey, you guys, thanks for all of your calls. Thanks for all of your opinions. Some strong ones, which, you know, we love around here, so... and Peter would be proud, Roy. 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to the phones once again. Hey, Betty, what's on your mind?
Turn down the phone. Hi there.
Hi, Betty.
Hi. I don't know if there's a topic going tonight. I just tuned in, and I hear a lot of talk about the economy, which, of course, is a disaster.
Yeah, we kind of started off talking about credit card bills and the rates, and I think we're just it's kind of like a gumbo stew at this point.
Right. Well, okay, because I sort of have been a little freaked out about what I've been hearing about a couple things. One is I heard, I think, that in the week or two or maybe 2 months that the Attorney General, the torture in chief there, has ordered AOL and all of the Internet companies to turn over every bit of information on their subscribers that they have. All the information of every email you've ever sent, everyone you've ever gotten, every, you know, place you've ever gone, in a computer bank, and Bush has ordered them to be turned over, and they were all turned over except for Google. This is what I heard last
week. Oh, yeah, that's a big controversy this week.
Then I talked, some controversy, huh? Then I talked to my friend today, and she goes, oh, Google was just taken over by AOL. So, hello, that's the end of that. Big Brother is right now got us by the big time. And then I'm hearing, I got very excited because John Conyers, you know, our wonderful congressman, had a meeting the other day in the basement in the Congress because they won't allow him to go into the meeting rooms. He had several, Bobby Scott and several great, Robert Wexler, you know, very good liberal, you know, concerned people that were congresspeople, plus he had a Quaker in the audience who had been being spied on by the FBI in their church, a 59-year-old disabled man and some old ladies and, you know, really dangerous people. And then they said, well, two lawyers, right-wing lawyers, one Bruce Fine, and you see they're talking heads during Bill Clinton, and the other one, Jonathan Turley, that was like frothing at the mouth to take Bill Clinton down over his big crime. The one Bruce Fine said, well, we can't go at this. The one attorney goes, Jonathan Turley, these are crimes about this NSA thing and, you know, tapping into all of our phones. And so the guy said, one of the people said, you know, one of the congressmen, if you keep saying these are crimes, then would you say they're impeachable? He said, I hate to say this because he's a Republican, but yes, I would. So then Bruce Fine, when they asked him, he goes, well, I don't think we should start out saying impeachment and talking crimes and scaring and getting hostile, because then the White House will just dig in and there'll be lawsuits for years and litigation. He goes, I think we need to talk to them and coax them and tell them, okay, sins have been made. I'm like thinking, this is a lawyer? Sins have been made. Well, he was a lawyer for Nixon and Reagan, so that explains it. And I'm thinking to myself, these aren't sins, these are crimes. Now, Bill Clinton committed a sin, okay? But apparently it was not. It was a crime to them. These are sins, or these are crimes. And today, I hear Dick Durbin, right? You know, the Democrat who's now mouthed off and said, great, he's not going to vote for Alito. Good. But then he turns around today and goes, well, if Bush wasn't happy, and he's not happy with the extension he has, you know, overcoming FISA, we can just change the law for him.
All right, well, Betty, thank you for your phone call tonight from Ann Arbor. We appreciate your opinions.
Can somebody feed in on that? Because I feel like I'm in Neverland here. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
All right, let's go to Andrew, who is in Farmington tonight. Hello, Andrew. Thanks for calling Night Call.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, you?
I'm doing all right.
What's on your mind?
I'm sorry?
What's on your mind?
Well, I've been listening tonight, actually driving back home, and been listening to some of your callers, and I can't believe some of the ignorance or some of the individuals that are calling in and talking to you about these issues. Number one.
All kinds of people tonight.
Well, yeah, but I got to tell you, forgiveness of debt, one of the main reasons that the Fed would be increasing interest rates is to control inflation. And we don't want the same inflation rate that we had under Carter. So the Fed basically controls the money supply so that interest rates don't go through the roof. And, hey, I got to tell you, it's not my responsibility to watch out for these folks that are calling your show and telling people that we need to forgive debt. If people overspend, they overspend, and somebody's got to pay for it.
Right.
I'm not going to work and put my family's future on the line so that somebody can overspend, and then basically I'm going to wipe their debt or their credit cards clean and pay higher interest rates myself.
What do you think the percentages are of people that actually just spend blindly and irresponsibly and just not think it through?
I would say about a quarter to maybe a third of the people throughout the whole United States are overspending.
Well, I started off the program talking about people, you know, basically people that had their back up against the wall and the interest rates are climbing and what do we do? You know what? I guess I was basing my thoughts tonight on a lot of people that I know that are hardworking people, that are responsible people, that just had a bad time and they were forced to use their credit cards and without, you know, they did think it through. They absolutely did, but they just got stuck, you know? And I guess I don't know what the percentage of people that is, you know, but with the economy being the way it is right now, I think more people are forced to dip into that credit card rather than using their cash, you know? So,
well, the biggest problem, and Kelly, I don't disagree, but the biggest problem is personal responsibility.
Yes.
I do agree with all your callers. We may be on opposite sides philosophically, but at least one thing we do agree on, and that is that in our schools we should be teaching savings and a little bit more financial and fiscal responsibility.
That was a good caller, wasn't it? I mean, I'm glad that he said that.
Yeah, I mean, I totally disagree with everything else he said. I think his brains are fried, but at least on that perspective, he's absolutely correct. Do you mind if I shift one last quick comment?
Heck no.
I am sitting in awe and in constant amazement. I served overseas for over a year.
Andrew, I think we lost him. This is Night Call, and I'm Kelly Brown. Hopefully we can get him back, because I think he had something else to say. So 313-298-WRIF. Andrew, are you still there? Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Go ahead.
I apologize.
No.
I served overseas for over a year. I am a reservist that came back a little bit over a year ago. And I served with a military unit that actually got a chance to see how we are viewed by a lot of the extremist Salafists and Wahhabists in the Muslim world. And let me tell you, I would consider myself to be an independent, open-minded, and thinking conservative. But I was very much in support of this president and what we're doing. When people are calling and saying impeachable about breaking the FISA law or tapping into lines or that our lines are being monitored by the FBI, these people are seriously out of whack.
Excuse me, Andrew, do you have your radio on?
No, I do now.
Okay, good. I don't know where I'm getting the feedback. Continue. Go ahead.
Okay, no problem. They are way out of line because, honestly, and Clinton used the same program. It was called Program Echo. There are a lot of different programs out there, and what they do is they receive an order to wiretap or to just listen specifically for specific words that are used by individuals that are communicating with individuals that potentially we have gotten information on of cell phones or internet communications of individuals that may be associated with Al-Qaeda. And you know what? If these folks are against that, I'm not willing to put my children's lives on the line so that these people can basically wage their war against Bush or anybody else. I don't care if they're a Democrat or Republican. I think that in some cases, with what I see as our future and our children's lives being potentially threatened by individuals that we think, you know, we should be all singing around a campfire singing Kumbaya with, that want to kill us and our children because either our position for Israel or because of our position as a whole being more a Judeo-Christian society, I'm sorry, I'm not willing to put my children's future in these people's hands. And having a great protest is all nice and good, but how many of these individuals drive American cars? They call your programs. How many of them drive Toyota Priuses and all these other alleged environmental vehicles? You know what? When they talk about our environment, they need to go to states like Illinois, southern Ohio, New York, Florida, Texas, anywhere outside of Michigan, and the economy is doing fairly well. I sit and am dumbfounded because these people are the same ones that say it's all Bush's fault, but they won't say anything else against an individual that supports their predominant party line. And these people also slam General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, and a lot of these people are, you'll find that what's interesting, and I read a document in Time Magazine that talked about a majority of the people that drive foreign cars are younger females because they believe that the quality is better. But yet you look at corporations, we demand Ford, General Motors, and Chrysler to have women on the boards of directors and as executives in the corporation. And I think that's great because they have really opened up our minds and shown our corporations how multiculturalism works to expand a better product and expand the workforce, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the Japanese, when they're flooding our market, or even the Chinese with this Geely or Chery car that may be coming in the next 2 to 3 years, how many of them have women on their boards of directors or as executives? But yet these liberal organizations support, like the Sierra Club, supports purchasing a Toyota Prius. These people should be ashamed of themselves.
Mm.
And the next time they talk about Michigan economy, they need to stop talking about the federal economy because the federal economy is doing really well. We're doing poor in Michigan. And I'm not going to point fingers at Bush or at Granholm. I'm going to point fingers at people that do not demand the quality out of the American automakers and just complain and do not purchase American products or American-made vehicles.
You know, it's absolutely overwhelming to pinpoint where everything is coming, where all of this is coming from, the economy and, you know, I almost don't want to say the economy anymore. I'm getting tired of hearing myself say that. but you know, it's not Ford, it's not GM, it's not anybody's fault in particular, it's the individual's fault, it is partially the economy, the E word, it's partially because of gas prices, it's partially because of foreign cars, and you know what, it makes my head spin because you can't pinpoint it. When you go on to one thing, you know, you started talking about that new car was in the article was in the paper today. Yeah. And then that makes you think about something else that's a problem, and that makes you feel like something else is a problem, you know? It's just like, oh.
But, Kelly, it does come down to manufacturing.
Yeah.
Because without manufacturing jobs, you don't have a middle class. And without middle class, you don't have the power to become an economic or military power. And quite frankly, when we buy foreign-made products, we're losing that manufacturing base in the United States.
Hmm.
And nobody can tell me that that's not where we're losing it.
Right. Well, keep that in mind, everybody. I'm so glad you called, Andrew. Thank you very much.
Hey,
you, like I said, you're making my head spin. I thought halfway through you talking, you were making a great deal of sense. I thought, you know what? Why did I talk about this today? What am I getting myself into? This is Night Call. I am Kelly Brown. Thank you so much for hanging out and giving me a chance tonight. Peter Werby is in Caracas, Venezuela, and will return in 2 weeks. As I mentioned earlier, hopefully he will give us a call. It's not looking like tonight, but maybe next week he will give us a call and tell us how the convention is going. We have a few things to take care of, and we'll be back with Night Call. Stay there.
This is Night Call.
Right on, you rock.
Here at 1 minute on the riff.
Buy it the next at WRIF.com. Just 99 cents gets you the tunes you love for your very own. Download it right to your PC.
Your Riff Rock online at WRIF.com.
I like it.
Everything that rocks. Rock.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Well, it's not Peter Werby this week. It's me, Kelly Brown. Thank you for hanging out. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Thanks, Jay Hudson, in the other room producing the show. Appreciate your help. He's pretty much trained me over here ever since the first day I got here. Thanks, Jay. 12:38 in town. This is Night Call. And, you know, we started off talking about credit card bills and credit card companies and all kinds of things. It always seems to go to Bush. Always seems to go to President Bush, doesn't it? I took something interesting out of, speaking of the economy, out of a Harvard magazine. It says, during the past generation, the American middle-class family that once could count on hard work and fair play to keep itself financially secure has been transformed by economic risk and new realities. Now a pink slip, a bad diagnosis, or a disappearing spouse can reduce a family from solidly middle-class to newly poor in a few months. People are barely hanging on. Middle-class families have been threatened on every front, rocked by rising prices for essentials as men's wages remained flat. Both dad and mom have entered the workforce, a strategy that has left them working harder to just try to break even. Even with two paychecks, family finances are stretched so tightly that a very small mishap can leave them in a crisis. As tough as life has become for married couples, single parent families face even more financial obstacles in trying to carve out middle class lives on a single paycheck. And at the same time that families are facing higher costs and increased risks, the old financial rules of credit have been rewritten by powerful corporate interests that see middle class families as the spoils of political influence. Interesting. You know, it's almost like you are, some people are a half a paycheck away from just, you know, being out of the house. Whether you're renting or you're paying a mortgage, it just, I don't know, like that lady that called earlier. She just seemed like she was barely keeping her head above water. But you know what? You just got to try to move forward. You got to try to do the best that you can. I took a little bit from every single caller tonight. I mean, you really have to try to do what you can do and let the rest go. Now, that's not the easiest thing to do. I mean, it's hard to live in the moment and not worry about tomorrow. That's very difficult to do. But you know what? Just keep telling yourself, you can do only what you can do, you know, and that's it. And try to not get stressed out about it. All right, that's impossible. All right, this is Night Call. Thanks for hanging out tonight. 12:41, let's go to the phones and take another phone caller. We have Eric, who is calling from Birmingham. Hey, what's up, Eric? What's on your mind?
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. I was listening to your last caller, and this guy's got it all wrong. I mean, it's okay to have an opinion and have a viewpoint on things, but this guy's got it all wrong. It's not about being a Republican or being a Democrat. It's about being an American. And what people don't understand is there was a time when government was there to protect you from being exploited by all these corporations. And now, basically, corporations are dictating to government what policies they want put in place, and the government passes the laws so that you have to abide by these policies. Your government's no longer protecting you from corporations or being exploited. And also, when he talked about being afraid for his kids, you know, from Al-Qaeda or terrorists, I mean, honestly, it's not, these people don't want to kill us. I mean, what people don't understand is that what happened on September 11th didn't happen because these people hate us. And that's what all this right-wing ideology is, that they just want to kill us because they want to kill. I mean, we've basically been doing things in that region for the last 40 years, and there's so much hatred that they wanted to come over here and say, you know, leave our countries alone.
You're saying that they don't want to kill us?
No, they do want to kill us, but it's not that, you know, they want to kill us just for the sake of killing us. It's because we've messed with their countries for so long. Our government has put in power all these puppet governments in the Middle East, like these kings. I mean, the British, the French, and our government basically put these people in power over the last 40 years, and the people that live in those countries can't change their governments because the CIA and their intelligence forces tell them about, you know, different forces within their countries that want to bring those governments down.
All right. Well, Eric, thanks for calling. Thanks for calling from Birmingham tonight. This is Night Call, and I'm Kelly Brown. Peter Werby is on vacation, and now let's go to Al, who is in Inkster. Hi, Al. What's on your mind?
I'd like to respond to the caller before last, too, on one issue. American corporations, the bigger corporations, no longer produce American goods. I used to work for a company where we loaded GM-made engines onto trucks and trains where they were transported to Mexico for assembly. Now, is that an American-made car? Part of it is, but the rest of it isn't. So how do you buy American? I mean, there is not one single vehicle on the market today that is wholly produced in America of American components.
Yeah, and what are you going to do before you buy a car? You're going to research every single part on the darn car? It is getting very confusing. It seems like it's all intertwined, you know? So,
yeah, it is intertwined. It's intertwined in, you know, everybody's desire to drive down wages. Everything's gone up in the last two decades. Productivity goes up.
Well, you know,
profits go up.
Right.
Wages go down. I mean, we're earning less, an hourly worker is earning less now, in not only in real dollars and real buying power, than a worker in the mid-70s. You know, and the caller that called in, one of the first callers, you know, called in talking about closing our borders because the immigrants are driving down the wages. It's not the immigrants driving down the wages willing to work for $5 or $6 an hour. It's the corporations and the companies and the businesses that hire them at that low wage and then expect us to work marginally above that.
Well, that's what I said. It's a little bit of everything. It's hard to pinpoint any one thing. And I do understand what he was saying. I know who the caller that was two callers ago. I do understand what he was saying. You know, it's easy to just make it as simple as buy American, because sometimes it's just not that simple. But I mean, in general, if you're, I understand what he was saying. I do understand what he was saying.
I do too, and I'll thank him for his service because I'm the son of a soldier. My brother was a soldier, and most of my family's been in one branch of the military or another. You know, but back to immigration, when it comes to immigration, we're all illegal immigrants. I don't remember the pilgrims checking in with immigration and immigration and naturalization.
All right, Al from Inkster, thanks for your phone call tonight. This is Night Call, and I'm Kelly Brown. Let's go to Jessica, who has been waiting a long time. Sorry, Jessica, what's on your mind from Ypsilanti?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
And I just want to congratulate you. You're doing pretty good. I listen to Peter Warby all the time, and it sounds the same thing.
Well, it was a little intimidating to begin with. Peter said, you want to do Night Call? I went, what?
Yeah, it's a pretty big show to take on.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, I want to say two things. I kind of wanted to bring us back to what we were talking about, credit and everything.
Oh, good. Thanks.
I think it's really easy to get distracted talking about Bush and everything, and it's important, but there's a lot of other things that are important, too, and I think you kind of dilute your message when you just get distracted going off talking about wars, and we're talking about credit, and that's what's going to affect most people, you and me. If you're not in the service, your family isn't, it's mostly going to be that. I want to agree with the guy who said you got to go forward with it, you got to talk to the credit companies, because my dad had a very large amount of debt. And he didn't have a job. He hasn't had a job, actually. He's still working like 10 hours a week because the company's trying to give him something. But he ended up working out a deal with the credit card companies where they told him if at the end of the month you can pay half of it, you give us half of your debt, all of half of your debt, we will forgive the rest of it.
Wow. Yeah, you know what? That's right. Sometimes people will compromise, especially like you know, I know some medical bills that you have for tests and things, sometimes they will compromise. And you know what? I'm glad that you brought that up because that was a really good point. And I think a lot of people avoid. And in the long run, that does create more stress because
you can't do that. You got to work out something for yourself.
Right.
You can't dig yourself out.
Right. Yeah. And because, you know, and you look down at your phone and you know that it's a bill collector.
Yeah.
So every time you look down at your phone a couple of times a day, you get stressed out. Well, just call and take care of it. You know, even if you call and say, you know what? Hi, I know I owe you money, but I don't have it. You know?
It's not going to happen. What can we figure out? And the thing is, I know that means that half his debt was forgiven. And I understand why, I think it was the guy a couple calls before saying you can't just forgive people their debt.
Right.
And that's true. But I think you have to think of it as a community thing. You know, as a community, we will either rise or fall together. And you're only as strong as your weakest man. You know, so, yeah, it's true. If you forgive debt, that means somebody's out money. Somebody is taking a pay cut.
Right.
You know, whether it's the corporate man or whether it's your best friend who works for that corporate man. You know, somebody's taking a pay cut. But when you owe $20,000 in debt, you know, $90,000 in debt because you have some massive medical bill and you make $9 an hour, you're never going to pay that off.
Right.
Ever. You know, and so you have to make a compromise between how can we figure it out so that some of this money does get, you know, we do get some of this money, but people don't just, you know, fall deeper and deeper into the hole. You have a community responsibility, you know, take care of each other.
Right, exactly. Well, good points, Jessica. Thank you so much for calling tonight.
Thank you. You're doing very well.
Thank you very much. Calling from Ypsilanti. Appreciate all your calls. We got another, I'd say about 10 more minutes for Night Call for tonight. Thanks once again to Jay Hudson for producing the program and helping me out. Let's go to Dan, who's been waiting a long time in Mount Clemens. Is it Dan?
Yes.
Hi there.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
You're doing a real good job tonight.
Thank you.
I'd like to say that one thing... There are several things that we really should do. For one thing, we have to stand by our union brothers and sisters. And you know, you always hear people that support, you know, companies that are not for unions, you know, like Walmart and stuff like that, and they don't realize that a lot of people that work there are getting messed over by them, you know, these companies don't support unions, you know, and they're non-union. You know, we need to support our union brothers and sisters. We need to, try to, you know, support, you know, the little guy, one thing that we can do is, our country can do is, all right, you know, if a company is going to go overseas, you know, we're America, we can't stop them from going overseas, but who is their biggest consumer? The United States. Okay. If they're going to bring their products back into the United States, okay, we're going to charge high tariffs on that product coming back into the United States. So if you're going to go over to Mexico, there's going to be not just Mexico or other countries, there's going to be high tariffs on your product coming in, you know, and I think that companies would think twice about moving to a different country if they realize that, hey, I might have to pay that tariff. You know, my all the people are going to have to pay that tariff, you know, my business isn't going to be doing so well if I go over there. I think that's one thing you know, they can do. Support protests, you know, like the one that was mentioned earlier. Another thing I'd like to urge is for our Canadian neighbors, vote liberal. Don't let the conservatives take over. You know?
All right. Well, Dan from Mount Clemens, thank you for waiting so long, and thank you for calling Night Call tonight.
Thank you.
All right. My name is Kelly Brown. This is Night Call. We have one more phone caller to go to before we wrap things up for tonight. Mark is calling from Riverview. Hey there, Mark.
How you doing, Kelly?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
Just a couple quick comments of some of the phone calls I heard earlier. One, the girl a couple phone calls ago said that we have a thing that we have to take care of each other as in brothers. And I believe, in a sense, yes. But realistically, why do I have to pay for somebody else's screw up? If you messed up in life and you put yourself so far in debt, why is it my responsibility that somebody like myself that's very conservative with my finances have to pay to get you out?
Right.
Number two is the guy was talking about unions, and we were complaining about outsourcing and all these companies and sending out work to other companies, you know, outside of the United States. And it's because partially because I believe in unions. I think they played a great part in the United States, but nowadays a lot of companies are willing to pay a competitive wage with competitive benefits, but also that it's benefiting the company also. You got to remember, these companies keep losing money. They can't survive, and they can't survive. There's going to be a lot of people without jobs.
Right.
There's not going to be a union. So the point is these unions won't bargain with the companies. They won't budge. They say, keep our wages, keep our medical things the way they are. Oh, and by the way, we want more,
mm-hmm.
a little bit more. And you keep asking for more, and these companies, to make a profit, have to do these things. And I don't think it's right, and we lose American jobs, and we have unemployment, like in Michigan, it's on an all-time high, which is ridiculous, but it's part of the system. These companies have to make money. They don't make money, they don't exist.
Right.
And that's just kind of some of the thoughts that I had. I mean, I don't think it all boils down, like you said earlier, to one thing. You can't pinpoint it and put your thumb on it and say, this is it, let's fix this problem and it'll cure everything.
No, and as I mentioned, I didn't really realize when I was looking over things to talk about this week, I more or less was looking at things that are directly affecting me, because, you know, I think that, you know, the things that are affecting me right now are affecting a great deal of people out there. And I was looking at, you know, my friends and a lot of different people that I know in the situations that they're in. Well, you know, you can't pinpoint one thing. You know, it's just, and I didn't realize what I was getting into with this topic, but what a lot of great points tonight. Mark from Riverview, thanks so much for calling. I appreciate it.
Okay, have a good night.
All right. Bye-bye. I'm Kelly Brown, sitting in for Peter Werby. This is a Night Call. Thank you for listening. He will be gone for the next 2 weeks in Caracas, Venezuela, at a convention. He didn't get around to calling us tonight, but he said he might give us a call some next week. It would be great to hear what he's up to at this convention. You know he's out there doing good things. Next week on the program, I will be here again. We will talk about health care. This is something affecting a lot of people, health care or lack thereof. Dr. Alan Olson from Marquette, Michigan, will be my guest via phone from the UP, so please join us for Night Call next week. I'll leave you with this. This is something else that I found out of Harvard Magazine. The 1-2 punch of income vulnerability and rising costs has weakened the middle class, at the same time that the revision of the rules of financing delivers a death blow to millions of families each year. Since the early 1980s, the credit industry has rewritten the rules of lending to families. Congress has turned the industry loose to change whatever it can get, and to bury tricks and traps throughout credit agreements. Wow. This is what happens when you don't read the fine print, you guys. Credit card contracts that were less than a page long in the early 1980s are now 30 or more pages of small print. In these details, credit card companies lend money at one rate, but retain the right to change the interest rate whenever it suits them. They can even raise the rate after the money has been borrowed, a practice once considered too shady for even a back alley loan shark. When they think that they have been cheated, customers can be forced to arbitration in locations thousands of miles from home. Some companies claim that they can repossess anything a customer buys with a credit card. Read the fine print. Have a wonderful week. I'm Kelly Brown. This is Night Call. Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF Detroit.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Ready to party in paradise with the Poobah?
Back like a heart attack.
Celebrating 20 years of Maui Time. 101 Riff and Budweiser are proud to present Maui Time 2006.
The concept!
Ready for some fun in the sun?
How'd you like to spend a week with the sunshine, the crystal blue water, and the black sands of Kahanapali Beach in Maui?
Why don't you tell him the whole story?
And just listen for those three magic words.
Not yet!
Now listen carefully for the directions.
When you hear them, be Motor City Caller 34 on the Rip Line.
And pack your bags, baby. You and a guest could be getting the hell out of the cold.
Partying with Arthur P. and the Riff in Maui. Maui Time, 2006.
20 years of Riff. Tradition continues.
From Budweiser. This is Budweiser. This is beer. At 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Baby!
WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me.
We're going to talk with an author that's written a memoir, actually her third, and I always admire people that do memoirs. Someone once said, I should do mine. I'm thinking, well, you either have to have notes or a memory. So I'm going to ask our guest about that as well. She is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Her third memoir is Blood on the Border. It's a memoir of the Contra War. And Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz is a professor in the Department of Ethnic Studies at California State University, East Bay. She's the author of Outlaw Woman, a memoir of the war years, 1960 to 1975, and also Red Dirt, Growing Up Okie. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, maybe we could we could start with my question. How does one reconstruct the past accurately so we get a rendition of not only a person's personal intersection with history, but the history itself?
Well, that's very controversial in the news now.
It is.
James Frey's Million Little Pieces, Oprah's pick. It's... You know, I'm a historian, and I have a doctorate in history, and my first six books I published were academic, scholarly books. I'm also an activist, so they were relevant and pertain to Native American issues, land tenure issues, and treaties and so forth. I decided in, while I was in Nicaragua most of the 1980s, I wanted to be able to write that history. I did publish one academic history and observation of what was going on there with the Contra War at that time. But I wanted to really be able to write so that I could get across the horrible results, consequences, damage done by imperialism, by United States invasions into poor countries, how it wrecked the lives of people. It killed 50,000 people in Nicaragua out of a population of 3 million. That would be like millions being killed in the United States. And yet people, you know, there was a big movement against it in the 80s, but it wasn't a number one issue for most citizens. And now it's been largely forgotten. So I started experimenting with writing in a literary form without the footnotes, without. And I ended up doing these three books of memoir. The first one is about growing up in rural western Oklahoma. My father was a sharecropper and farm worker, and my mother was part Indian. My father was from Scots-Irish, you know, typical poor white southerner. And yet his father had been in the Industrial Workers of the World in Oklahoma. And Oklahoma was, at its beginning in the early 20th century, really the most militantly radical workers' movement and farmers' movement, farm workers' movement, in the whole United States during a very activist era. And I wanted to, that history has been largely forgotten or suppressed in Oklahoma, so I wanted to be able to tell that story with by telling my grandfather's story and telling the stories I had heard, actually, in my childhood. That's just an example of the three. With each of them, I do meticulous research. I don't depend only on my memory at all. I am good about, in the third one, I have, you know, notebooks that I kept. I had quite a bit to check my memory. And many times my actual memory, I would prove myself wrong about something, a date or a name or a situation. And so I used my historical training methods to write this. It's just what's different about it is, one, I put myself into the picture,
mm-hmm.
which historians avoid at great, you know, all costs.
Well, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, your third memoir, Blood on the Border, a memoir of the Contra War. Maybe we should remind people of the Contra War. We're talking about a population, excuse me if I'm insulting anyone, whose historic memory usually goes no farther back than Enron or maybe Monica Lewinsky. So we're talking almost 25 years now. So remind us what the Contra War is, and maybe in discussing that, you used a word back there that I think needs some precision to it, imperialism.
Right.
Usually that's something from the Cold War, imperialist dogs and that kind of stuff. But flesh that out for us, if you would.
The word is making a comeback. All these books coming out by even right-wingers who say it's a good thing. You know, the United States is an empire, and that's great.
Yeah, okay.
But it has come to the forefront again, and I've always used it. For one thing, I did my doctorate in history, in Latin American history, and the term was, and this was in the 1960s at UCLA, and it was not a radical department by any means, but there was no avoiding using the term Latin American imperialism, U.S. imperialism in Latin America, because, well, that's never really been denied. You know, we still, the interventions and gunboat diplomacy is the, but then most people don't study Latin American history, so they're unfamiliar with, even that.
Essentially, it's an extension of an empire abroad and the domination of other economies and countries.
Yeah, it's really an extension of a state beyond its borders, not just with mutual exchange, but unequal relationships where there's a dominance of, the United States politically, militarily, and economically that then aggressively uses that to control peoples in other states, their politics, their economies.
Right, so it was the 1980s, and suddenly you're down there for quite a while. Here you're from a poor white family in Oklahoma, and you're getting a doctorate in history, and that's quite a journey. How did you wind up in Central America?
It is a journey. I call my first chapter in the book, The Road to Nicaragua Led Through the Black Hills. I got very involved in the early 70s in the American Indian Movement, just as they occupied Wounded Knee. This is probably something people have also forgotten, but there was a very militant Indian movement that then established an international wing, and I think a lot of people don't know there is a international indigenous movement, and that can be connected, for instance, with the election in Bolivia of the first time an Indian Native American president of a country, Evo Morales. So that's, that's been developing for about 30 years, and I've been intensely involved in it. And this really led me to my work on, Native American issues, because I was invited down to take a look at the land tenure issues of the Mosquito Indians of Nicaragua in a tropical forest area in the northeast of Nicaragua. And this was 1981, May of 1981, I went down. And by that time, Ronald Reagan had been elected and inaugurated and had quickly implemented a plan to overthrow the revolutionary government that had taken power in 1979, the Sandinistas.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, really the trying to recruit these Mosquito Indians who lived on the border. In fact, their people live on both sides of the border with Honduras. So there was, this program, which was to go back to the Vietnam era, was implemented something called a secret war in Laos, where the Hmong people there in Michigan probably have some Hmong population. There are a lot in Minnesota and California. The ethnic indigenous group that was recruited by the CIA and then pretty much abandoned, and when the United States left Southeast Asia. So it was implementing that same plan on a border area to get a people who weren't that integrated with the rest of the country and resentful and neglected and extremely impoverished to get involved in this really mercenary war that was being designed in administration. And so that's why I went down the first time. Of course, I was excited when the Sandinistas won in 79. I knew some, but I was really doing other work, you know, in the indigenous movement, and I probably wouldn't have gone and gotten involved had it not been for my connections with indigenous issues. Well, that became a prime front in the Contra War. It was less known. In fact, it was in many ways a secret war, because what was known was in the western side of Nicaragua and Central America, where the mestizo, you know, the former National Guardsmen of the dictator, were financed by the Reagan administration to attack peasants, to attack any clinics that the Sandinistas built, any kind of infrastructure, and really terrorize populations. And the U.S. Directly, CIA mined the port, the main port for Nicaragua, and for that, Nicaragua won a case in the World Court against the United States. They developed torture manuals. Much of what we see going on in Iraq right now, the same old hands who carried out this Contra war are in charge of the war in Iraq, and the torture we see and all this comes directly from Central, you know, sort of transported, and it's meant to terrorize people. That this is what will happen to you if you dissent. You'll be put in Abu Ghraib, or you will be sent to Guantanamo. And it's I think it's especially important to know something about the Contra War to see the continuity of the present. You know what we're actually.
Sure. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. Her book is Blood on the Border, a memoir of the Contra War. It's published by South End Press. You can go to my website, peterwerby.com, and link on to it, or go to southendpress.org. And Roxanne is going to be speaking this coming Thursday, January 26, 7:30 p.m. at the University of Toledo at Rocket Hall, room 1520. And also the next day, Friday, January 27, 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the University of Michigan's Haven Hall, and later in the evening, 5 p.m. at the Planet, a nice little coffee house in Ann Arbor. We'll repeat all that at the end of the show as well. We've established this history, and hopefully either people have heard it for the first time and it's going to set the context, or their memory's been jogged about this awful and unconstitutional intervention that the Reagan-Bush administration carried out in the 1980s. And tell us some about your direct experiences. Were you under fire? Did you, what happened while you were there for years and years? I mean, I know that's a long story, and that's why you have your book, but maybe some signal instances.
Sure. I went down on many trips. The longest I stayed at one time was 3 months, but I went on dozens of trips there, and also to Honduras, where the Contras were you know, based to make attacks. I was in a war zone. I've never been in a war zone before. I am not an intrepid adventurer by any means, or someone who follows wars or whatever. I'm a real scaredy cat, and it was quite terrifying. Landmines were planted all over the region, so that, you know, jeeps blew up all the time, or just people walking, and it was just arbitrary, you know, whoever happened to hit it. And the Contras kidnapped, often tortured, and on several occasions killed any Americans, or as they call them then, internationalists from Europe or Japan or anywhere in Nicaragua, in addition to killing, you know, the peasants themselves.
And well, how does a scaredy cat deal with this? I
also tell a kind of parallel story in the book about my abuse of alcohol. I honestly think, as bad as it was, and I've been in recovery now for 8 years, but I had had an earlier bout, and I have alcoholism in my family, and I had gone through recovery, but the third time I went to Nicaragua, I started drinking again, and I really think, had I not had the strength from the insanity of alcohol, I probably would not have done some of the things I did. I mean, it was a crutch and an enabler, but it also had the usual awful effects of not always making the best decisions and sometimes taking risks that beyond, what I should have. There were just the usual things of being in a completely undeveloped and remote zone. There were very few roads in the zone. There was no electricity, no kind of communication. I mean, this was way before the internet, but there were no telephones. There were no newspapers even. Information was lacking. It's a very one of the most underdeveloped areas of the whole world. Almost all travel was by boat through the waterways, and of course the oceans there, and the main artery, the Rio Coco River, is the border with Honduras. It's also a tropical rainforest, so that it rains in the rainy season. Not any kind of rain, probably, that anyone listening has ever experienced, unless you've been there. It's a hard rain. People call it feels like swords and daggers hitting you, blunt ones, but nevertheless just pounding you. You cannot walk, and you can be knocked down by it. Well, the rivers swell, there's flooding. So when you're going on these rivers, they turn into rapids, and I had ridden the rapids once before, and it terrified me up in the Sierras. And here I was, I said, I'll never do this again. And here I was in dugout canoes, running rapids so much fiercer than anything, in the Sierras.
And this was, you were with the Mosquito Indians? Yeah, okay.
Traveling around the area.
What were you doing specifically? I mean, what were your tasks? Or?
Well, it changed. I went down to do the land tenure study. In 1980, I had published a book called The History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, which looked at Indian, pre-colonial Indian land tenure, the Pueblo Indians, and then what happened to that under Spanish colonialism and then under United States after United States took half of Mexico, which included New Mexico. So some friends of mine who had, were from here and were Nicaraguans and part of the revolution, were now in government. One particular friend, Roberto Vargas, who's a fairly well-known poet in the United States, he was in the Ministry of Culture. And he asked me to come down, invited me to come down for the land tenure study. Well, once I got there, this conflict was brewing. And by the time I went back in December, the Reagan administration had funded the CIA secretly $20 million to launch the Contra War, and they called it Operation Red Christmas. So that was my first experience with it. The Nicaraguan airline that I was taking to Nicaragua was blown up in Mexico City before we boarded, or we would have been killed.
It was blown up?
Yeah, blown up. And so
And this was like a sabotage terrorist act?
Yeah. Someone got on in El Salvador, planted the bomb, and got off in Mexico City. And we were supposed to have been boarded and in the air by then, but The flight crew had got stuck in traffic in Mexico City and were late, fortunately. But a baggage handler and one member of the flight crew were killed.
Wow.
That was an
exciting entry point.
And, in all the lists, talking about, wiping out memory and history, in all the events, every time there's a sabotaged airplane, terrorist attack on an airplane or suspected, the New York Times always lists all of the air, you know, all of the air disasters related to terrorism. They never list that one. And I wrote them a letter once, which they actually printed, but they still don't list it. After the Pan Am 101 in Lockerbie, Scotland, I wrote, I was just furious. I said, how come, you know, this was 7 years ago, and I would have been killed on that airplane. You never list it. So it's, you know, it's just sort of forgotten. But by the time I got down there, the attacks had begun from Honduras on these, there are about 90 mosquito villages along the border in Nicaragua, and the attacks on those villages across the border sent many people across the river into Honduras, where then they weren't allowed to come back by the Honduran military. And John Negroponte, who was the ambassador to Nicaragua from the United States, pretty much personally micromanaged setting up refugee camps there and then putting out propaganda that these Indians were fleeing Nicaragua because of Sandinista
atrocities and attacks on them. I do remember that. You know, it's funny, a story like this goes by so quickly, and we're heading towards the end of our conversation with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz. Her memoir, The Contra War, is called Blood on the Border. Looking back on it, and you did draw the parallel with Iraq, but your experiences, was there any grand lesson to you or a sense of that it made some sense for you to be there?
Well, you know, it was, and looking back on it, I think the lessons learned, I do feel I was able to be a part of helping resolve an agreement between the Sandinistas and those Mosquitos who had joined the Contras. They resolved their differences 3 years before the actual Contra War ended, and I was able to get into the refugee camps by late 1984. The United States kept a close hold on them until then and wouldn't let anyone in except people like Pat Robertson, the fundamentalist that you see today so active. That's when they started getting into politics. Reagan just, you know, open the doors and allow them to go down there and missionize and take even arms to the Contras. And they particularly were enamored as the Mosquitos who were a part of the Contras. And so I was able to tell the people in those refugee camps were being told that all of their relatives in Nicaragua had been killed. So I came with pictures, you know, as I got to know them in 1981, new families. And, you know, I grew up in a rural atmosphere, so I know, you know, I know how everyone knows each other. In some ways, people are related and everything. And I would know when they would tell me this or that person was dead, you know, the spouse or family members. I'd say, no, they aren't. I just saw them, you know. I was just down there and I saw them. They said, they didn't believe me, so I started taking pictures that were date-stamped, letters from their relatives, and gradually they began to realize they'd been lied to. So that, I felt, I was able to play a role in helping save lives and for people to be able to go back home and be reconciled, reunited with their families. But what a cruel thing, you know, to tell people sure. that relatives are all dead.
Well, we've only told just a bare part of the story that Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz tells in her third memoir, Blood on the Border, a memoir of the Contra War published by South End Press. You can go to my website, peterwerby.com, or southendpress.org. Or, Roxanne, do you have a website that you
would send? Yes, I do. It's www.reddirtsite.com. AREDDIRTSITE.
I have to check that out myself. And if you'd like to hear more of Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, she'll be at the University of Toledo on Thursday, January 26th, Rocket Hall, at room 1520, 7:30 p.m. Also in Ann Arbor the next day, Friday, January 27th, 11:30 a.m. at the University of Michigan's Haven Hall. Later in the day, 5 p.m. at the Planet. So more in store if you attend these talks. Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you, Peter. I enjoyed it.
This is WRIF.com. And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 48220. You're listening to WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. I have a book here. It's called The Impossible Will Take a Little While. The author is Paul Rogat Loeb. And the subtitle is A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear. And it occurred to me, although this book, I would say, and we'll ask our guest, mostly has a perspective from the left, this could apply to almost everyone in this society, a time of fear, whether you're afraid of terrorism, whether you're afraid of the increased power of an imperial presidency. And here, a country with so much promise, so much wealth, so much land, we live in a time of fear. Paul Loeb, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. Am I right on both accounts?
No, I think you're very right. I mean, in fact, I wrote it trying to sort of do two things, which may seem a little incompatible, but to me they made sense. One is huge number of people demoralized by the Bush administration and everything they've done in terms of undermining democracy and just widening economic disparities and trashing the environment and all those kinds of things. But then beyond that, trying to say to people, look, if you really believe that there is nothing that you can do, that everything is hopeless, well, that's an awfully bad way to live your life. And so even if, in fact, you may depart from my own political perspective, it's still important to be able to understand that citizens have the ability to make change. And so what I did is I've written 4 previous books on sort of citizen movements directly, Soul of a Citizen being the last one, the one that probably got out the most widely. But in this case, I took the essays that inspired me, basically from writers, well, really all around the world. I mean, Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela and Vaclav Havel and Eduardo Galeano and Maya Angelou and Alice Walker and on and on and on. I sort of combed my bookshelves and said, well, who keeps me going? Because I have to admit, this is I put the book initially together right after the initial, I guess, the mission accomplished phase of the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone I know who had worked to try and stop that war for reasons that now seem all too absolutely right was just completely in despair. And I thought, well, what can inspire people? What inspires me? And that was the genesis of the project, is the idea is to pull together just stories and poems and memoirs and give us something to be able to say, all right, we're not powerless, even in a time that's, I mean, to me, I'm 53 years old and I've been active since, I don't know, age 14 or something like that. This is clearly the most difficult political time that I've lived through, and yet you have to be able to look beyond the short-term horizon and still see ways to be able to make change.
Sure.
And so that was a project that I took on.
Well,
impossible.
The impossible will take a little while. I'm still almost stuck on your subtitle, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear, and I was trying to think through that, why we have developed this national ethos of fear. I mean, certainly, just like one has to be alert while they're driving, for instance, there's people out in the world that mean us harm. We saw its greatest manifestation on September 11th, 2001, but I certainly don't live in fear,
right,
that that's going to happen again in that magnitude, and I'm not even saying it won't, but I don't live in fear of it. And
it's not dominating your day-to-day life.
Yeah, it's not, and I certainly don't. I think my odds against being involved in it are pretty low, yet there is a palpable fear, and what was the old phrase, fear and loathing as well, that's afoot in the land. And I began by saying it's not just on the liberal left or the progressive left, but it's people that have even no political identity per se. The people say, I'm an independent or I'm in the middle. And then that becomes fears about the economy, about the future, their financial future. So.
And a lot of that's justified in some sense.
Sure.
That, I mean, my mind, one of the reasons for, I guess I'm thinking of the sort of resurgence of global fundamentalism, including the United States, is the sense that the ground that once seemed solid suddenly turns to sand. We assume you have a job and a pension and you can pay for medical care if you get sick, and all of a sudden all those things are called into question. And one of the responses, of course, in this culture and others as well, is find the scapegoat, don't look at the actual real roots of the problem because they seem difficult to address, and look back to the imagined golden age when we followed the Ten Commandments and everything was fine. I like that there's actually, I live in Seattle, and there's a very, very right-wing, I think he's got a radio show, rabbi named Daniel LePan, who has a group called Toward Tradition, and he was one of the people who was caught in the Jack Abramoff scandal. And I like the notion that Toward Tradition, yes, there's a venerable tradition of bribery, corruption, all of that, you know, in this sort of imagined perfect world that the political right likes to envision.
Tell us a little, your book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While. You were indicating some of the authors, particularly some of the international authors. I was looking through the list of how many I've been fortunate enough to interview here. And how does one go about getting the rights to reprint anybody from Nelson Mandela to Bill McKibben or Alice Walker or Jim Wallace or Cornel West, Howard Zinn? Do you have to write every single person or publisher of those authors and say, yes, Paul Loeb can put it in his book?
Well, there's actually a two-phase process. The first, which was extremely pleasant, which is writing all the people in the book who I knew and had corresponded with, which is a fair amount of them. There's a significant overlap between the writers in The Impossible Will Take a Little While and the blurbs for Solo Citizen. So Howard Zinn, Marion Wright Edelman, I mean, all those folks who know and like my previous work. So they're very responsive and immediately saying, well, yes, of course, we'd be delighted. Then you come to dealing with the publishers, and particularly the Random House group was just absolutely nasty. And I remember the famous phrase, and I said, well, let's try and find a way to work this out. And they said, we're not here to work things out. We're here to write contracts. And when Alice Walker, Jonathan Coslin, Terry Tempest Williams all volunteered to waive their share of the fee, Random House responded by promptly doubling the fee.
Oh.
So, this this is a very sort of a close to home example of greed in action. But what do? You bite your teeth and you say, all right, you're going to pay this fee because you want these pieces in there. So it was interesting. The other thing that I did that was interesting was I have a very large email list, actually. People go to the impossible.org website, they can sign up for it. I've something like, I don't know, 15, 18,000 people on it.
And is that the web address, impossible.org?
Yeah, impossible.org.
I'm surprised you got that. I'm sure that would... but go, you know how people grab those kind of little neat phrases. All right, we'll put
it's
a...
It's theimpossible.org.
I'm sorry, what?
It's theimpossible.org.
Oh, theimpossible.
Yeah,
all right. And
impossible is taken. And so what I did is I use it to send out articles about a couple times a month, and I emailed everybody, and I said, I'm doing this book, Who Inspires You? And I got amazing essays in, combination of people who were sort of, for instance, there was a wonderful Ariel Dorfman piece that I had literally was in the middle of composing my letter to him to say, do you have anything? And arrives on the doorstep saying, I heard through the grapevine that you were doing this book. He wasn't even on the email list at that point. Maybe you can use something from this memoir of mine. And then people who are completely unknown. There was a woman who was... And she was a graduate student just from a very poor background talking about just her turns and twists of a really interesting political life and struggling with life-threatening disease. And this is this amazing piece by a writer nobody had ever heard of. And so that's in there next to Mandela and Havel and all the sort of giants of our time. And then I used some other stuff that was just for my own. There was a kind of appropriate for this past week we were in is I did a piece on Rosa Parks a few years ago where I looked at the kind of mythology and where the image of her stepping out of nowhere onto this bus in Montgomery, Alabama. And I thought, wait a moment, she didn't step out of nowhere onto a bus. She'd been an NAACP activist for a dozen years. She'd gone to the Highlander School, the Labor and Civil Rights Center in Tennessee, for training the summer before her arrest. This wasn't a lone action. It was an action that was very much part of a conscious community that she, in fact, had helped build over the years. And there are people like the labor organizer E.D. Nixon, who worked with the Sleeping Car Porters Union, founded by the great A. Philip Randolph. He was the head of the NAACP in Montgomery and actually got King involved. And on and on and on. I thought this is a kind of microcosm of the way that we take conscious community citizen movements that are collective movements and make them seem as if just sort of random individual actions because somebody's feet hurt at a particular time. None of which takes anything away from Parks, of course. Mm-hmm. What it just says is that she wasn't an accidental figure. She was a very conscious actor on a historical stage with other people, and that in some ways you could say that her first NAACP meeting was just as important as a stand on the bus because one led into the other. And so I talked about even the question of how you assess impact and then trying to ask the question in my mind of, well, how did Rosa Parks get involved? And we know that her husband Raymond was involved in the NAACP before her and got her involved. What we don't know, at least what I don't know, is who got Raymond Parks involved, because it's not in anything I've read. And yet you've got to figure that some anonymous person in a time that seemed immensely difficult got another anonymous person named Raymond Parks involved, an ordinary person, a barber. Then he gets his wife involved, Rosa, who's no one has ever heard of. And then a dozen years later comes something that everyone acknowledges is making global history.
Sure. Well, I think we should talk about this, the meaning of your title. The book is The Impossible Will Take a Little While, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear. My guest is Paul Rogat-Loeb. And you can go to theimpossible.org or to Paul Loeb, Loeb.org as well. I'll have a link on my site, peterwerby.com. And when I speak to people today, although people that are even activists, like I was at a Martin Luther King Day march in downtown Detroit, and there's probably about 1,000 people. We're talking about a metropolitan area of 6 million. So although there was enough people there to make it feel like it was more than just a lonely few, One wondered, why isn't there 20,000 or 50,000? Like there has been marches down when Dr. King marched down Woodward Avenue here in Detroit in 1963 in April, and with 150,000 people, for instance. And the idea begins to sink into many people that this is more what we're involved in now are symbolic acts, because power is so entrenched that it is so impervious to popular control, that it is moving completely in the other direction, that it is impossible, that you can't fight City Hall. Yet when you go back and look at our history, I think it's Zinn that says we lose every battle but win every war in terms
of... And in Zinn's essay, he talks about this sort of, calls it the optimism of uncertainty, unexpected turnings of history. And here you are, you're doing something, it seems completely futile, and then unexpectedly, history turns, and you never know. I mean, I tell a story in The Impossible of a friend of mine who's now a retired MIT professor. At this point, she was a young widow with three kids at this vigil in D.C., and it's rainy, and the kids are crying, the signs are running. It's just sort of one of those glum days, and we're not talking 1,000 people. We're talking 30, maybe, and feeling completely powerless, completely useless. And then a few years later, this is in the early 60s, she's at a rally on nuclear testing, and Benjamin Spock, the baby doctor, who did baby and child care, was sort of probably the best-known doctor in the world outside of maybe Jonas Salk. And when he started speaking out, first on nuclear testing and then against the Vietnam War, made a huge impact. And he's talking at this rally, and he's describing his own journey. And he talks about the issue some, and then he talks about this day in Washington, D.C. on a rainy afternoon when he happened to be walking near the White House and saw this small vigil and drew closer to read the signs and thought, boy, these women are committed. Maybe I should think about these issues as well. And my friend realizes that in this moment of just powerlessness, at least apparent powerlessness, she in fact has done something that brought in somebody who's immensely consequential. I mean, actually, the Vlasov Havel essay in The Impossible Will Take a Little While makes it the same point on a kind of larger global scale, because he's talking about the growth of the democracy movement there, and he's actually writing in 1986, so 3 years before the Velvet Revolution that overturned the dictatorship. And he actually traces it back to a rock band, Plastic People of the Universe, that was inspired by some American musicians of the 60s like Frank Zappa and the Velvet Underground.
I was going to say, yeah. That was their big inspiration.
It was a huge inspiration, and the authorities did not like their music, and they said it was, I love the phrase, morbid and not socially constructive, which is one of these great bureaucratic phrases.
All the conservative critics of rock and roll, beginning in the 1950s, and some that continued even into the 60s and 70s before it came completely just the popular music of the Western world, they were right about rock and roll. Hey, Paul Loeb, you're going to be in our city. Those of you who are listening who are members of the Michigan Education Association, Paul Loeb is going to give the keynote address on February 10th. I'm just curious. How do you, or are you a teacher? How do you come?
No, I mean, I lecture all over the country and at colleges and conferences. And basically, people call me and email me to come in and speak, and I talked to an NEA conference in Los Angeles, and somebody from Michigan heard me and liked what I said, and that's usually how it travels. We're also doing a public talk on the February 11th at 7 o'clock at the Workman's Circle in Oak Park, and there's info on the website of that as well.
And I'll have it on my calendar. It's the Workman's Circle in Oak Park on February 11th.
Yeah. Looping back to the Havel story, though.
Sure.
What's so interesting about the way he frames it is he's describing Plastic People of the Universe. So you have this sort of global leap from American rock and roll over to Czechoslovakia. And then when the authorities tried to essentially, well, first break up their concerts and harass them and jail them and finally put them on trial, Havel forms a defense committee. And what he says is unexpectedly that defense committee evolves into Charter 77, which then becomes one of the pivotal groups in organizing that eventually brings down the regime. And I love that sort of global unexpected leap of history from defending the rights of a rock band to bringing down this dictatorship. And those are the kinds of things that, in the darkest times, we can never anticipate. The other interesting thing in the Havel story is he's describing at one point circulating a petition to free some political prisoners and getting mocked for his efforts. And people are saying, this is not going to do any good. You're just being indulgent. You're trying to get attention. Why don't you quietly help behind the scenes? And Hava writes about 7 years later. He says, you know, we actually did not succeed in freeing any of the prisoners, so I suppose you could say that the critics are right. He said, but I wouldn't say that because when they got out of jail, they said that our solidarity allowed them to act. They didn't feel isolated. They didn't feel alone. And then at the same time, all those people who signed the petitions, they didn't stop there. They've gone on to challenge the regime in so many different ways that they can't jail us all. And he had a faith that it would indeed bring the dictatorship down. And to me, this is an example of two things. One is just a sort of, I don't know what you call it, the contagiousness of courage. One person inspires another, inspires another. And then at the same time, that you really don't know who you're going to be bringing in and if you're bringing somebody into a citizen movement, what they may go on to do. Because it turned out in that case that they didn't achieve their immediate goals, and yet all those people who they brought into the movement went on and did in fact turn out to provide a force capable of bringing down a dictatorship. And I think about that in terms of the anti-war movement of the last couple of years, that if, and you know, and right now it's a big if because some of it has certainly melted away, but if we could actually bring back in all those people who say we're on the eve of the war, we're marching, mm-hmm. and get them involved in a way that was ongoing, that was, you know, where they were reaching out, furthering discussion, I mean, now so much more ammunition to be able to raise these issues, that's very powerful, because what you want to do is, at least my goal, and this is true in all of my books, it's true in The Impossible Take a Little While, it's true in Soul of a Citizen, it's true in everything I've written for 25 years, I want to get people involved in the stream of social justice involvement for their lives, because if you have enough people doing that, that's when you begin to turn societies around.
Sure. Well, the involvement is the key. Sometimes I say to people that this current era is like the 60s and 70s writ small. Although, on a local level, most of the turnouts in the Detroit area are pretty small, and people have scaled way down their expectations,
right.
Way down. Yet some of these national demonstrations are bigger, like marches on Washington or the February 15th, 2003, the tens of millions of people around the world protesting.
The largest ever. Right?
Yeah, the largest ever. Yet, I wonder sometimes about the internet and email, that it, on one hand, it giveth many, a way to contact one another, and on the other hand, taketh away. Because if you think about these huge demonstrations that occurred previously, going back to the 1930s, people had to crank out leaflets on mimeograph machines. They had to send out letters. They had phone chains where one person would call more people. And it does not seem to have the public arena does not seem as filled as it could be and should be, given the breadth of concern about these issues that you talk about in your book.
Well, I think you're right that the email, it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, I mean, you look at a group like Move On that I work with them, brainstorm with them. I think they're a wonderful presence. And two things occur. One is it does make it easy to participate. And people who once would feel, say they're not in Detroit, they say they're up, you know, just, I don't know, I was in the Upper Peninsula in fall speaking, you know, so, you know, some remote area, and, you know, you feel like there's no other progressive people within miles around, you're tied into something larger. That's tremendously important, and I'd never underestimate its value, nor the ability to actually at least put your name on record with a click of a mouse. That's extremely important. On the other hand, the trap is when you start believing that that's the be-all and end-all. And I would actually argue that long-term, the most important thing that a group like Move On has begun to do in the last 2 years, partly because the technology made it possible, is when you're able to have those localized events face-to-face that are created electronically. So to take the example, when they had the Cindy Sheehan vigils this summer, I live in Seattle, and I punched in my zip code, and there was one about a mile and a half away, and there's 350 people gathered, pulled together by a woman whose actually husband was over there fighting in Iraq, who basically said, here's the location, here's the time, come gather. I knew, I think, three people of the 300. All the rest of them had turned out through these electronic connections, but now we're able to talk face-to-face and build something further. And so I think what you really need is you need to pull those two things together.
Well, as we sort of head towards the end of this interview, the subtitle again, I keep going back to, Hope in the Time of Fear. And very frequently when I end interviews, I ask people there who are advocating change, and usually we're talking about, and this is quite different, Paul Loeb, as I realize, I always say, is there the political will? Like they'll say, this statute has to be changed, or we have to expand this, or we have to have national health insurance. And maybe that goes back to the historian Howard Zinn's remark about what was it again about the unexpected?
The optimism of uncertainty.
The optimism of uncertainty.
Right. Or Jim Wallace says, hope is believing in spite of the evidence and then watching the evidence change.
Yeah. So how do we keep up hope? And hope is one of those intangibles. I can be totally pessimistic and you can be totally optimistic and we can be standing, in the same spot.
Right. And this is a real core lesson of The Impossible. It'll take a little while. Is that Havel actually makes a distinction between hope and optimism. He says, optimism is the belief that things are going to turn out well. And sometimes you have that and sometimes you don't. I'm not sure that I have that right now. I don't know that they're going to turn out well. I mean, I see at least, some real possibilities that we're in some spiral of environmental assaults and assaults on democracy and all the rest that could just terrorism and the responses to it that could get much, much worse before it gets better. On the other hand, hope, he says, is that ability, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's the ability to recognize that your actions matter and that in some sense the future is in your hands. Whether or not things look good in the short term, there's a young African-American activist from Atlanta, who I quote actually both Soul of a Citizen and The Impossible, will take a little while, and she says, you've got to pick your team. And there's a team of the cynics who say nothing is going to change or it's only going to get worse. And, let's be honest, they've got some evidence on their side. But there's also the team of the people with hope. And we've got some evidence on our side as well. If you look at history and those unexpected turnings. And she said, we're not going to know who's right till the end of history. And unless we completely annihilate everything and, in our lifetimes, we're not going to be around for that point. So it makes more sense to live with the team of hope. And I think that's true. I mean, it's a statement about where we want to cast our lives is to recognize that, at least from my study of history, and that's probably what fuels me the most, that and the kind of community that gets built at its best, it's impossible to say, you'll always lose, because there's always these moments where you win.
Yeah.
And the other side, yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's also how you live your life.
And it's how you live your life.
And ultimately, it's about ethical imperatives, but it also has to do with what kind of planet are we going to live on, and what do we have to give to our children and grandchildren. It's all my life. It's gotten me involved with some of the most wonderful and creative people, and at some level, although very frequently it's very kind of reform work is very daunting and sometimes depressing, it's something that actually gives one a sense of fulfillment and gratitude. I should have given you the last word, Paul Loeb, but I'm out of time.
We'll have to talk again.
We will. And if you'd like to hear Paul Loeb, if you're a member of the Michigan Education Association, Paul will be at the annual convention in Detroit February 10th. The next day, though, in a talk open to the public.
And free
at Workman's Circle in Oak Park. I believe that's near Greenfield Road. And this will all be on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, PeterWerbe.com, Paul Loeb, L-O-E-B, .org, and also TheImpossible.org. That website from the book, The Impossible, will take a little while, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear. Paul Loeb, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
My pleasure.
Right on, you rock.
You're at 1 minute on the riff.
Buy it the next at WRIF.com. Just 99 cents gets you the tunes you love for your very own. Downloaded right to your PC.
Your Riff Rock. Online at WRIF.com.
I like it.
Everything that rocks. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Milford, Plymouth, and Shelby Township all spell rock. W-R-I-F. Everything that rocks.
Sure. Woodstock Talk of Rock Doug Podell this Wednesday night for one smoking hot night with the 2006 Hawaiian Tropic International Pageant, only at Wild Woody's. See if you can pick who will be the winner. Which of Metro Detroit's sexiest women will compete at the Hawaiian Tropic Party before the big game February 3rd? It's happening this Wednesday night at Wild Woody's on Gratiot, south of 14 Mile in Roseville with 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks. Rocks.
Do out and seek your truth.